This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents The Path Made Clear. Written and narrated for you by Oprah Winfrey.
The Path Made Clear, Discovering Your Life's Direction and Purpose. To the teachers who help us realize we can take on the world. Introduction. There is no greater gift you can give or receive than to honor your calling. It's why you were born and how you become most truly alive. The simple act of asking, "What is my purpose?" on the internet has the power to elicit nearly 1 billion responses. That's a staggering commentary on the way so many people feel about who they are and how much they long for an existence that matters. On the surface, typing those four little words, "What is my purpose?" and pressing enter may seem trivial, but it's really a profound reflection of an intimate prayer rising from the deepest part of the heart. It's asking to be acknowledged. Initiating that search is a sign that the journey toward an elevated life filled with meaning and character is ready to begin. And here's the great news. Beyond the labyrinth of digital links, there is really just one being who holds the keys to unlock the answers to all that you were meant to become. That miraculous soul has been speaking your entire life. Of course, I'm talking about you. I believe every one of us is born with a purpose. No matter who you are, what you do, or how far you think you have to go, you have been tapped by a force greater than yourself to step into what I call your God-given calling. This goes far beyond what you do to earn your living. I'm talking about a supreme moment of destiny, the reason you are here on earth. Each one of us has an essential role in the whole of humanity. All you have to do is follow your path to answer the call. In the words of the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. My hope with The Path Made Clear is to offer the wisdom of experience from the visionaries, artists, teachers, and trailblazers who've walked this road before you and who've shared their inspiration and lessons with me. The common thread among them, they have discovered that in this world, there is no real doing without first being. Within this book, you will find a guide to activating every layer of the miracle that makes you uniquely you and applying it to the life you envision. Committing to a life of purpose takes courage. There was a time in my own life when I felt torn between who the world was telling me I should be and what I felt to be the truth of myself. Today, I know for sure what I'm here to do. That's because I started listening to my instincts and paying attention to the decisions I made each and every day. If you're at a crossroads in your career or relationship, if you're struggling with finances, with addiction, or to take control of your health, the journey to lasting change begins with defining what matters most to you. All of us have a limited number of years here on earth. What do you want to do with yours? How do you want to spend your precious, ever-unfolding future? There's no need to waste another day wondering if there's more to life. There is, and it is yours for the finding when you're ready. Chapter 1. The Seeds. Your life isn't about a big break. It's about taking one significant life-transforming step at a time. August 14th, 1978. It was a Monday, my first day working on a Baltimore talk show called People Are Talking. It was also the last day I had a job. Up until then, I'd been a news anchor and reporter. I knew I was not my authentic self in those jobs, and my bosses certainly made no secret of their feelings. They told me I was the wrong color, I was the wrong size, that I showed too much emotion. I've always said that the best part about that experience was meeting my best friend Gail, who was a production assistant at the same television station. I could feel I was misplaced, even though the 6 o'clock news was a time slot most young journalists covet. I was never fully comfortable in that seat. And when I look back at the tapes, I can still hear the pretend anchor voice I used on air. It wasn't until I was unceremoniously demoted to co-host of People Are Talking that I experienced the first spark of what it means to become fully alive. During the show, I interviewed Tom Carvel, the Carvel ice cream man, and the actor who played Benny on All My Children. Not exactly glamorous, but as we talked, I felt lit up from the inside, like I had come home to myself. When the hour ended, there was a sense of knowing resonating within my heart and radiating to the hairs on the back of my neck. My entire body told me this was what I was supposed to do. As a reporter, I had been exhausted all the time. I really had to drag myself many days into work. But after one day on this local talk show, I was energized in a way that fueled every cell of my being. There was no doubt that the seeds of what was to give my life meaning and purpose had been planted. That day, my job ended and my calling began. Years later, The Oprah Winfrey Show would achieve a level of success no one could have predicted. It was an exhilarating experience, and yet another little kernel of knowing was revealing itself to me. Even at the show's peak, I had a deep awareness that a supreme moment of destiny still awaited me. That's why, after 25 years, I trusted my instinct when it told me, this isn't it. There's more. There's something else. The show was my home. The audience was one of the great loves of my life. But I couldn't ignore the flicker of certainty telling me it was time to move on. The years following the end of the show brought many unexpected possibilities, and I had some daunting moments when creating a new cable network, OWN. Stopping to consider my own advice of turning challenges into opportunities is what allowed me to move forward. This is the lesson I hope you take away from this chapter. Your life is not static. Every decision, setback, or triumph is an opportunity to identify the seeds of truth that make you the wondrous human being that you are. I'm not talking just about what you do for a living. When you pay attention to what feeds your energy, you move in the direction of the life for which you were intended. Trust that the universe has a bigger, wider, deeper dream for you than you could ever imagine for yourself. Growing up in the church, one of my favorite Bible parables was about the mustard seed. If you have faith, even if it's as little as a mustard seed, you can move mountains. Anything is possible. As a child listening from my seat in church, this brought me so much comfort, just as it did when I was struggling as a reporter in Baltimore, and as it still does today. The mustard seed is such a tiny speck of a thing. I am emboldened by the belief that all I need is a mustard seed of faith, and no matter what, I'm going to be all right. As you begin to identify the seeds of knowing along your own path, the first question to ask yourself is, what do I believe? Do you believe that you are worthy of happiness, success, abundance, fulfillment, peace, joy, and love? What I know for sure is you become what you believe. The quotes and conversations I've selected for this chapter reflect insights into the depth and length of your constant spiritual growth. Leading us first is author Sue Monk Kidd.
I think life is a process. You wake up, then you wake up some more. You die to oneself, you're reborn. It's an evolution of consciousness. I mean, if you look at the way God created the world, it's always about a seed and a sprout and a flower, and then it goes back to seed. It's always about process and unfolding. I think we're probably on a journey of greater and greater consciousness, becoming more compassionate, more loving. And that is a lifelong spiraling process.
And now, Tim's story.
You really are a miracle in motion. Motion is movement. So we're not there yet, but we're in motion. At all times, we are all going through recovery and discovery at the same time. Some people stop their lives because I'm in recovery. I just went through all this and I'm in recovery. But you should be in recovery and discovery.
Here is Dr. Shefali Sabari.
Whether we like to recognize it or not, even the most unconscious person, against their greatest will, they are on a process to evolve. Life gives us opportunity after opportunity to ask yourself, is this my truest self or am I living the inauthentic self? Becoming conscious means to recognize when that moment arrives. And it's coming, and it's coming, and it's coming.
Listen in on my conversation with Pastor A.R. Bernard.
Do you believe that everybody has a calling?
Absolutely.
How do we open ourselves to that calling? How can we be more open to hear and more open to find the path that is our calling?
First, we have to believe that we do have a purpose. It goes back to that eternity in their hearts.
Every person has a purpose.
Every individual has a purpose. And when we begin to think that way, we will appreciate the sacredness of all life and not be destructive to any aspect of life, because too often people think purpose is static. It's that one thing for which I was born.
Yeah.
But what happens if you achieve that at age 27? You have no reason to live beyond that.
Correct.
Purpose is not static. Purpose is dynamic. Purpose continues to be applied throughout your life. Your gifts, your talents, and abilities that are given to you by God, that remains consistent throughout your life.
Here's Barbara Brown Taylor.
I have relational callings. I have professional callings. I have a number of different callings. And I also think it's possible to be called away from things I have been called to in the past. But I've been powerfully called to some things and just as powerfully called away from them. So I think that's important, too. There are goodbyes as well as hellos in our callings.
And now, Elizabeth Gilbert.
For some reason, and this just boggles my imagination, there are still just huge swaths of women who never got the memo that their lives belong to them. And there's this instinct that they have that they need a permission slip from the principal's office for anything. You are allowed to ask yourself some really important questions about your life. You are allowed to take accountability and ownership for your own journey. You're allowed to ask what serves you sometimes, because I know you've been trained up to serve everyone, but you're allowed to turn that on yourself and honor your own life that you were given. And I feel like it just got to people somehow that they hadn't quite put together that they could do that. You get the question. Here's the question. What have I come here to do with my life? You telling me you never got that question? That's the question that begins every single quest. What have I come here to do with my life? There's no one who hasn't had that question come to them. That's the call.
Right.
Now you can choose to ignore that question or you can pursue it. And the pursuit is the beginning of the journey.
Here's what Bishop T.D. Jakes has to say.
So if we can get the clutter out of our mind, if we can get the guilt out of our mind, if we can get the shame out of our mind, if we can get the worry out of our mind, if we can get the busyness out of our mind, then all of a sudden we're going to have ideas which are seeds. And the seed of an idea planted firmly in your mind, where you believe in yourself and you believe in your potentials and you believe in what you got and you believe in your stuff, it's good. My thoughts are good.
Here I ask Jean Houston, what is the soul?
I believe that the soul is the essence of who and what we are. I personally believe that it transcends our leaving this mortal coil. I think in part it is also that great friend that I talked about, that it comes with codes and possibilities and the next layers of who and what we may yet be. It is often a pain in the neck because it says, wake up, it's time to wake up, don't go to sleep. I think it is also the lure of our becoming. That's what I think the soul is.
Wow. Got to take that in a minute. The lure of our becoming.
Yes. And is part, for me, it is also part of the evolution of our becoming, because we are coded. We are coded in ourselves. We're becoming, we are coded in our hearts, and we are coded into, we are God seeds, becoming God selves, I think.
I just love tweetable moments. Here's one of many with Carolyn Mace.
If you have life, you have purpose.
That's a good tweet.
If you have life, you have purpose.
Tweet. That's a good one. If you have life,
you have purpose.
And that is true of every one of the seven billion of us.
Totally. It can't be otherwise. And this is why I absolutely love studying the work of the mystics, because this is what's so extraordinary. The tiniest truth is the same at the big level. If you have life, one drop of life, one atom is as purposeful as our planet.
Wow.
What is in one is in the whole.
Wow.
It can't be otherwise. It cannot.
And now, wise words from Deepak Chopra.
If you're rested, if your mind is in peace, and if you're full of love and compassion, if you come from being and then feeling and then self-reflection, then things will synchronistically fall into place, because that's how nature functions. Like a seed.
Yes.
In every seed is the promise of thousands of forests. So like that in your karmic seed.
So to have the desire means you can accomplish it.
Otherwise you wouldn't have the desire.
That is amazing.
You have unique gifts. Focus on the gifts. Don't focus on the weaknesses, because there are other people who complement your weaknesses and you'll complement theirs.
Do you believe everyone has a gift?
Yes.
Otherwise you wouldn't be here.
You wouldn't be here. And that gift is, when you're expressing yourself in that unique way and giving out your gifts, you lose track of time.
Chapter 2, The Roots. I don't believe in coincidence. I know there is a divine order to the magnificent mystery of our lives. One of my greatest joys is watching someone experience an aha moment. I delight in seeing that person's eyes light up with the spark of understanding, especially when that recognition might change the trajectory of his or her life. My hope at the start of every conversation is to expand hearts and to create an open space for learning. This is because I've always known that teaching is my true calling. It's the taproot from which all of my other skills and talents grow. I felt this even when I was a little girl playing school in my grandmother's yard, trying to get my cousins, Willie Mac and Lonnie, to spell the Bible names Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego correctly. Any chance I got to play teacher, I took it. Author James Hillman calls this the oak within the acorn. We were created as individual acorns in need of nourishment and proper conditions to help us grow into mighty oak trees. I firmly believe it is no coincidence that I ended up sharing wisdom with millions in what became the world's largest classroom, The Oprah Winfrey Show. It wasn't kismet, serendipity, or even plain old luck. I don't believe in luck. For me, luck really means preparation, meeting the moment of opportunity. I was born to teach. My only job was to listen, trust, and obey the call. The same is true for you in following your call. In this chapter, you will hear stories of others who tapped into their unique essence, took a leap of faith, and now have a clear understanding of who they are and why they are here. Like me, they've come to know that there is no moving up and out in the world unless you're fully acquainted with the person you are meant to be. What an unbelievable world we would live in if everyone were doing exactly what they were created to do. A few years ago, I was talking about this very idea with Amy, my chief of staff. Amy's job is to keep all of the trains in my life on track, while at the same time juggling a wide assortment of daily curveballs thrown our way. It involves a whirlwind of multitasking. As Amy and I talked about recognizing one's early unique gifts, she had her own aha. She told me that when she was young, all she wanted for her 8th birthday was a filing cabinet. She just loved the idea of labeling the files and managing paperwork. She also had a calendar before there were events to even write in it, and printed rainbow business cards so that people knew she could organize their lives. Now, Amy's job is to organize mine, and it makes me smile to see her delight when she's checking off a list. She followed her calling all the way to my office in Hollywood. Of course, your purpose doesn't have to be tied to your career. I have many friends who told me they knew they were meant to have children before they even understood what it was to conceive. I've always believed that accepting the call to be a mother is the choice to become the ultimate spiritual teacher, because mothers live in service and sacrifice to their children. Whatever your calling, it's already rooted within you, and those roots can be trampled or tugged at, but never removed. They grow stronger only when tended, nurtured, and most important, shared with others. My deepest desire is for people to get still enough to identify what makes them unique and connect to hope, possibility, and fulfillment in all areas of their lives. As author and spiritual trailblazer Gary Zukav so brilliantly taught me, when you align your personality with your purpose, no one can touch you. For many of those featured in this chapter, the signs and signals of a personal calling revealed themselves in early yet profound ways. Let's start with Nate Berkus.
I was the kid that cared so much about the things around me, cared so much about the way things looked, but more importantly, the way things felt, that I was tortured by sharing a bedroom with my younger brother. And for me, it was my own space. And my mother knew that, I don't think she knew that I would end up working in design. I don't think she knew that I would end up being on your show. I don't think that anyone predicts or tries to or dreams for that. But what she did know was that her son was the kind of person that had to control the way a space felt and the way a space looked, and that I would get great pleasure out of not just the privacy. That wasn't the point. It was the selection. It was the process. It was watching a space that was raw concrete walls in a basement be transformed into a space where I could live out my daily life.
Because when you are connected to those kinds of things, meaning your inner world, the space around you really matters, because the space around you reflects your inner space.
And I think it's universal. I think no matter who we are or what we have or we don't have, everybody wants to live better.
Sometimes all it takes is one person to believe in you. Here is Brian Grazer's story.
So you weren't a great student.
No.
Didn't even read well. I mean, no. Back in the day, you would have been called dyslexic, probably.
Yeah, definitely.
Right?
Definitely.
And your mother was really upset with you because you were failing the third grade, which is reason to be concerned.
Yes.
But your grandmother wasn't worried.
My grandmother wasn't worried. She liked all the questions I asked and always give me an answer. And she'd always say, Brian, you're going to be special. You're going to use this curiosity. You're going to be a special kid. And I often was looking at my report card while she's saying, you're going to be special. My report card said all F's and D's. And I'm going, does she know what's going on here? I'm getting all F's and she's telling me I'm going to be special. But she just had this sustained belief in me and validated me for questions. But I did use this curiosity to meet new people in subjects that I would have never learned anything about. And by meeting these new people, it's given life to movies and television shows I've done. It's helped me in my personal life with my children. It's been a powerful force in my life.
Here's insight from Lin-Manuel Miranda.
My parents both worked really hard. I have never known either of my parents to have just one job. They always had many jobs at once, and they worked really hard so that we could have the things we wanted. I grew up aware of that, but we also grew up in a house where they were not around for the 9 to 5. We all ate dinner sort of at our own speed. I ate dinner when I went home. You ate dinner when you got home.
Everybody sitting around the table.
Yeah, no, it was sort of every person for themselves. But they were there for the important stuff. They never missed a play. They were very present, but they weren't around. And so, as my Twitter followers will know, because you will see hours of VHS videos and movies that I made growing up, I had this enormously rich, imaginative life.
Ellen DeGeneres shares what she knew to be her own path.
It was very clear to me. I saw things that other people didn't see. And I saw things that weren't either valued or understood or paid attention to. And that's, I think, why I became a comedian, because I noticed all the little the spaces between all the things that everybody else paid attention to. I paid attention to the in-between stuff.
Tracy Morgan can pinpoint exactly where his comedic roots were planted.
When did you know that comedy was a way out?
And my dad was funny.
Yeah, your dad was
funny. He was Richard Pryor funny.
He was Richard Pryor.
He did it in Vietnam.
Wow.
He was funny, so I didn't really stay under my friends. Mm-hmm. I'd like hung out with my dad and his friends. The conversation between his friends and him were more stimulating. I couldn't learn nothing from my friends. They knew what I knew. Mm-hmm. But I could learn from my father and his friends. He was funny. I remember when he came to the projects, everybody came out because Jimmy's here. And he would start snapping on people and ranking on people. And I remember him sitting me on his lap at 4. He said, say your mother this and that. And I said, your mother. And everybody started laughing. And I liked that. And that's how far back it went. It was my dad.
I have to say, Sister Joan Chittister's story of how she discovered her purpose was a first.
I've never quite met anybody who knew at 3 years old, standing looking in a casket, that being a nun was your calling. Can you tell me how you knew that?
Yeah, I do. It was quite clear to this little mind. My father had died. He was 23. My mother was a 21-year-old widow with this little baby. She dressed me to take me to the funeral parlor. Her brothers and sisters said, you cannot take that child to a funeral parlor. Mm-hmm. My mother said, her father died. She has to grieve like we do. She's going. So she's holding me now in front of the casket. I've got my little hands around her head. I can feel the tears. Her face is wet. I know something terrible, but I'm looking over her shoulder like I'm looking there. And down there at the end of the casket, I say, Mama, what are those two things? What are those things? There at the end. And my mother hugs me a little and she says, honey, those are sisters. Those are special friends of daddy's and special friends of God's. They taught your daddy in high school, and they're going to stay here tonight. And when God comes for daddy's soul, they're going to say, this is Joan's daddy, and he's very good. Take him straight to God. And I said to myself, I want to be one of those. I thought that was the best job in the world. You just sit around waiting and
helping people's daddies get to
That's
God.
Right.
Helping people's that daddies was, get
and
to
I spent
God.
The rest of my life racing across streets to say hello to nuns. Hi, sister. And I went to a Catholic school, and I was not disappointed. Those sisters were loving, they were smart, they were competent, and they became a model of womanhood for me. A long time before there was any language for it.
Here is Reverend Ed Bacon.
When I was 5, I was playing alone in a pine grove in South Georgia. And all of a sudden, I felt enveloped by warmth and light. And I heard inaudibly, the deepest part of myself, you are the most beloved creature in all of creation. At the same time I got that message, I also heard, and every other person is the most beloved creature in all of creation. Changed my life. It made my life what it is.
Trailblazer RuPaul Charles and I connected on so many levels during our conversation.
I knew that you were my kind of human when I first heard you say that we're all born naked and the rest is just drag.
Yeah.
I have a different way of saying that, but I mean the same thing, that we're all in these kind of body suits, mm-hmm. and you come up with these definitions and these ideas about who you really are. Mm-hmm. But we all are, my favorite quote, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who said, we are spiritual beings having a human experience.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I got that as a kid. I was a young kid and I thought, is everybody getting that this is all kind of an illusion? And I couldn't get anybody to corroborate with me until...
Do you remember the first time you thought that, though?
I remember when my parents were in the living room going crazy, beating each other up. I knew, this can't be right. But when I was about 11 years old on PBS, I found my tribe in Monty Python's Flying Circus. I thought,
really?
Okay, they get it. They're irreverent. They're not taking anything seriously.
Right.
And they're having fun. That's what this is all about. I got it very early. My sisters also, you know, we laughed. That was our sanctuary, was a place where we could find some peace.
Hear how Glennon Doyle listened to her calling.
So I knew I needed a place to tell the truth, and I actually did start feeling this invitation to start writing. Mm-hmm. Like, it felt like an annoying tap from God, like,
really?
Get off the couch and start writing. But I ignored it because I just love watching TV. So one day I was passing the computer and I saw this thing going on Facebook called the 25 things. So my friends were just like making lists about things about themselves. And I thought, awesome, I can make a list. So I sat down at the computer.
Was it 25 things you don't know about me?
Right. And so I walked away and 2 hours later I came back. My list had been shared all these times from my personal page and I had 27 new emails. And I thought something.
And your sister called.
6 times.
Yeah.
So that's our bat signal for like, I've done something inappropriate that's going to require a lot of cleanup on her part. That's when I thought, oh, I really should have read someone else's list before I did mine. So this is my number 6. I'm a recovering food and alcohol addict, but I still find myself missing booze in the same twisted way that we can miss people who repeatedly beat us and leave us for dead. But here's my friend Sarah's number 6. My favorite snack food is hummus.
Wow.
Oprah, all of mine were like that. That was like the most lighthearted one. And so I thought, oh, we're not doing that here either. We weren't doing that.
Yeah.
And I wanted to die. I just wanted to just take it all back. But then later that night, I started opening those emails from people. And they were from people who I had known my whole life, but I had never really known. Because these emails said things like, oh my gosh, Glennon, I just read your list and I've been bulimic for 12 years and I've never told anyone. Glennon, I just read your list. My husband and I are struggling. We don't know where to turn. And on and on. And I thought, this is interesting. This truth-telling is something that can unlock people. Mm-hmm. I felt connected, the real me to the other real other people.
Vice President Joe Biden set high goals early on for himself.
Did you live up to your own expectations? Did you fulfill the vision or exceed the vision that you had a picture in your head of the kind of man that you wanted to be?
I, by and large, believe that I have ended up being the man I wanted to be. But it wasn't in terms of accomplishment, because people usually translate that into, you know, as a young guy, I knew I wanted to be senator. I knew I wanted to be president. That wasn't true. What was true was I wanted to live up to my parents' expectation. And I wanted to be that person that met my mother's standard, being defined by my courage. I wanted to be that person who, no matter what happened, just got back up and kept going. I wanted to be that person who was there and loyal to people who were loyal to him. I wanted to be there. I wanted to be that guy who knew what was worth losing over.
Wintley Phipps shares a lesson in destiny.
When the things that you dream of as a kid and you watch them come to reality, those are moments of destiny. But then I began to realize that, and God showed me, the moments of destiny are moments for which you were created, but they're not the reason for which you were created. The reason for which we were created is to grow every day to more resemble, reflect, and reveal the character of the one who created us.
Mm.
And that's what happened to me at 16. And so I'm hearing in my head, at 16, I've seen your dreams. Now give me your dreams, and I will let you see a glimpse of what I've been dreaming for you. Let me tell you, God is the ultimate dreamer. And when he dreams, he also dreams about us.
Yeah.
He dreams about you. He dreams about me. And the most amazing thing that can happen in the life of a human being is to catch a glimpse of what God's been dreaming for you.
Chapter 3, The Whispers. Passion whispers to you through your feelings, beckoning you toward your highest good. For me, the early days of 2018 will forever be marked by the devastating mudslides that swept through my community of Montecito, California. 22 people perished in the powerful avalanche of earth and debris that surged down the mountains in the aftermath of deadly wildfires and torrential rain. As I watch my neighbors gather to grieve, link arms, and ultimately endure, I was reminded of how, in a flash, your entire life can be changed forever. Natural disasters, illness, accidents, and unexplained events. There are gut-wrenching moments occurring every day that can blindside even the most aware and bring us to our knees. This experience has heightened my understanding of what circumstances beyond our control really means, and it's made me more attuned to what we truly have the power to control. The mudslides were a phenomenon. There was no way to prevent the catastrophic tragedy that literally came crashing through people's front doors. But that's not the case for most personal struggles. Situations like job loss, financial problems, a painful breakup, or a chasm between you and your child might feel like a shock, but they rarely arrive without whispers along the way. Over the years, I've taken every opportunity I could to share one of my most cherished spiritual principles. Your life is always speaking to you. It speaks in whispers, guiding you to your next right step. And in many situations, the whisper is also the first warning. It's a quiet nudge from deep within saying, something feels off. It's a small voice that tells you, this is no longer your place of belonging. It's the pit in your stomach or the pause before you speak. It's the shiver, the goosebumps that raise the hairs on the back of your neck. Whatever form the whisper takes, it is not a coincidence. Your life is trying to tell you something. Heeding these signs can open the doors to your personal evolution, pushing you toward your life's purpose. Ignoring them, sleepwalking through your life, is an invitation to chaos. Life is about growth and change. And when you are no longer doing either, you've received your first whisper. Pay attention to what makes you feel energized, connected, and stimulated. Follow your intuition. Do what you love, and you will do more than succeed. You will soar. The upcoming examples you'll hear help illustrate both the miraculous and disastrous outcomes that can occur depending on how you respond to life's whispers. I'm particularly struck by the conversation I had with author, speaker, wife, and mother, Shauna Nyquist. Shauna was married, raising two sons, and traveling the country with a full-time job when she realized she could no longer ignore the ever-increasing warning bells that the life she wanted did not resemble the life she had. As we talked, Shauna shared how, in her case, the signs were both physical and spiritual, and how by finally taking the time to listen to the call and create the changes she most needed, she found peace.
If we went out to dinner and talked about the things that mattered to us most, I would say family matters so much to me.
Yeah.
My spiritual life matters to me. A deep sense of connection with the people that I love, play and memory making and adventure, that's who I am. And if you looked at my day-to-day life, you would say, frankly, who you are is exhausted, isolated, anxious, not sleeping well, always hustling to leave something early to come late to the next thing, skimming in all of my most important relationships, hoping that they'll still be there when I get back from this thing or that thing. So I was forced to realize that the gulf between the two was growing at quite a rapid rate. The idea I had in my head and the thing I was.
What is the thing? Was there a moment that you were forced to look at yourself? I think the moment when you're out in Maui with your son and it's beautiful and you should be enjoying this amazing moment. That's one of them. I want to share that.
Some people recommended this beach that was like the best snorkeling ever. And so I went with my son. He's 8 at the time. We're holding hands. I mean, it's one of those picture perfect parenting moments. We were like, this is it. I'm going to hold this in my heart forever. It was like two halves of my brain and two halves of my heart. And I had this deep, I think the best word I can think of is self-loathing. This, I hate myself. I hate being myself. I'm the problem with everything. I'm ruining everything. The set of voices, I couldn't figure out why they were coming out at this point, except I realized it was the only time I'd been silent in as long as I could remember. Complete, total silence. Not my own voice chattering, not my kids, not my husband, not my to-do list running in my mind, uh-huh. Not me running from one thing to another, complete total silence that I did not choose. And it was in that silence that I realized there are a lot of things I think that I've been running from, that I've been hiding from. And I've been using busyness as a defense, as a barrier against facing. Where are these feelings coming from? What are they about? What will it look like to heal them and bring them out into the light? I was exhausted. And for me, my exhausted self is my worst self. I'm short-tempered. I'm anxious. I get controlling about stupid things. Things need to happen my way when I'm really, really tired.
Okay, you said if somebody had offered you the opportunity to do anything you wanted, like a blank check, you would have said,
I just want to stop. Just everything. I want to stop this fast-moving train that my life feels like. And that's not me? Mm-hmm. I'm a dreamer. I am an adventurer. I'm not a person who just wants to stop.
I would take the check just to be able to do nothing for a moment.
Yeah, yes. And that showed me, like, I don't want to be that person.
And also, something you said that struck me, that you were productive, 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 but you knew you were not well.
When I look back, I had migraines. I had vertigo. I had what our family affectionately termed the stress barfs, where I would just throw up several times a week when I got anxious about something.
You weren't sleeping.
Not sleep. I would wake up every day at 3 a.m. These are warning signs. I wasn't listening to my body. I wasn't listening to my soul. I was just continuing to
work. So even when your body is saying something's wrong, because waking up and barfing, your body is trying to speak to you. I always think that everything is speaking to you all the time. Your life is speaking to you all the time. But even then, you couldn't hear it or called it something else.
I think I was so invested in the perception of being known as a highly competent, responsible person. And that was so important to me that I sacrificed my physical health, my emotional health, so that I could be known as someone who's really, really capable.
Here's Bishop T.D. Jakes.
We are not using our life, our time, our energy for our highest and best use. And something in the back of this brain back here is going, ding, 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 ding. You're missing it. You're missing your life, your purpose, your passion, your excitement, your enthusiasm. And through these classes, what we want to do is shake you and rattle you and stir you up to understand that every moment is a gift, every second is a gift, every thought is a gift, every idea is a gift, every opportunity is a gift, everybody you meet is a gift. You are gifted with opportunities, and I want to show you how to begin to maximize what you've got.
And now my conversation with Danny Shapiro.
I was waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, every morning, into this state of sort of existential panic. I didn't know what was wrong, but there was this feeling that I was falling and that there was just nothing to catch me. Mm-hmm. And I intuitively knew that it had to do with a spiritual crisis.
You know, what's interesting is you were feeling this sense of angst, this sense of urgency, this sense of flooding your body all of the time. But at least you were feeling it. I think so many people are so disconnected and numbed by the routine of life that they don't even have an opportunity to stop and know what they're feeling.
Well, the feeling that I had was that I would get my whole day done and check everything off every list that I had to do and drive everywhere that I had to drive and do everything that I had to do, answer emails and just do all of the things in that endless kind of...
And then your last thought at night is, oh, we're running out of dog food.
And
the same thing that everybody
hits
goes
pillow,
through.
Fall asleep, and then something in my being was forcing me awake because it was the thing that I hadn't dealt with. It was the most important thing, but what happens in life is it's just very easy to say, well, I'll deal with that later. I'll get to that at some point.
Yeah. So you're blessed to have that restlessness, really.
Yeah, it's a gift.
It's a gift.
It's a wake-up call.
Carolyn Mace.
We have an intuitive voice in us. We are born intuitive. We are so intuitive that it's actually, for most people, the source of their greatest suffering, all right? Because people hear when they've betrayed themselves. People are very much aware when they are not honest with themselves.
Okay.
People, it's that voice that says, you shouldn't have said that. You know that's not right. It's the voice of your consciousness. It's the voice you don't want to hear that never turns off.
Okay.
And when you follow this voice and you push, this is the part that says you should push and you should do this. So it's the part that keeps us moving and turning the wheel of our life. It's also the part that says you've done as much as you could now. It will guide you. It will say this is it.
So what you're saying is exactly what I've always believed and how I've operated. Being able to accept lives with within the range of doing all that you can do.
That's
and
right.
when you have done everything
right.
that you can do,
that's
you
right.
surrender it.
That's it.
Let it go.
That's right.
To the power and energy that's greater than yourself.
That's it.
That's what you do.
That's right. Give it your all, give it your best, and this inner voice.
And then not be attached to the outcome.
Totally. You got it. That's it.
Adyashanti shares his powerful insight.
I think it all ties down to our identity. What we really, really are. Because if we don't know that, what we're doing is we're always living a life where we're chasing to fulfill a sense of self, which feels underneath it inauthentic. That's just rampant in our society, isn't it?
Yes. Oh,
I don't like myself. I have bad self-esteem. And then life becomes a compensation for not knowing who we are, because it is almost like a wound within us when we get disconnected from the truth of our being. We do feel that. And then we're trying to fill it with love or approval or success or the million ways that we seek fulfillment from outside of ourselves. And no matter how much fulfillment we get, there's that place inside that until we've realized the truth of our being, until we've realized we are a presence primarily and a person secondarily, we will feel estranged from our own being and each other.
Jon Kabat-Zinn, the master of mindfulness.
We're mostly totally the same as human beings. Our minds are unruly. We distract ourselves infinitely. We're like out of our minds a lot of the time, but we have the capacity to know it and therefore drop back in.
I think that's true. We're out of our mind. No, we're out of our awareness most of the time.
And out of our hearts.
And out of our hearts.
What mindfulness is saying is find your own way. Listen to your own heart. Listen to your own, use the word longing.
Longing.
Listen to your own yearning. Because what we're really trying to do is live our life as if it really mattered.
Because it does.
And now, a teachable moment from Pema Chodron.
My whole life, I've had that instinct of what's forward. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It makes all the sense to me. I think everybody has patterns.
Yeah.
And it's your job to figure out what your pattern is. Mine is, I've learned as much as I can learn doing this thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now I need to
go
forward.
Yeah.
And it happens when I've learned as much as I can learn at that thing. And then something else opens itself.
And nowadays, forward, I never know where forward is going to be these days, you know.
Yeah.
But somehow there's always forward.
A forward, yes. I think as long as there's still breath, there is forward.
Yeah, I think so too.
How do you define spirituality versus religion? What is spirituality?
It's like getting into a boat and leaving the shore and going out where you can't see the shoreline anymore. Yes. And you're not really sure if you're ever going to get back because it's
so vast and open. Yes, I love that.
And that's what I mean about when you stop being fixed about how it has to be and who you have to be, you're more like a river than a rock, if you know what I'm saying. Like it keeps moving forward because that's natural.
Listen to how Amy Purdy followed her instinct and finally found peace.
I want people to not look at my story and say, oh, it's amazing what she's done. That's so inspiring. I want them to also feel that they have that inside of themselves.
Yeah, to live an inspired life.
Live an inspired life.
Yeah. Well, you're doing that. You know you're doing that.
So I've had all these little whispers throughout my life. You're meant to do more, Amy. You're meant to do more. And now those whispers have quieted down, I feel like, because I'm doing it.
You're in the space where you belong.
Right.
Yeah.
And here, inspired words from U.S. Representative John Lewis.
We were just ordinary human beings, ordinary people, touched by what I like to call the spirit of history. Some force just grabbed us. People had to do something. Then people had to say something. If not, I don't think history would have been kind to us.
And now, Wes Moore explains how he found clarity.
You know, oftentimes I would think that, oh, well, I'm just waiting on God to tell me where he wants me to go.
Yeah.
I'm just, God, tell me, what is it you want me to do?
Yeah.
And I've come to a very clear understanding now. It's not that God's not talking to me. It's that for so long, I just haven't been listening.
Yes.
I've been allowing so much of the noise to cloud this conversation I'm supposed to be having. And I've been so distracted that he's been sending messages this whole time.
Kerry Washington has this to say.
I really believe that if I want something, that God has three answers. It's either yes, yes, but not right now, or no, because I have something better in store for you.
And now, a powerful lesson in direction from Thomas More.
The ultimate care of the soul is being so identified with the life that wants to live through you. That's that idea of that dream wants to be embodied. I mean that very practically. So at any point in your life, you may get the hint that you should be moving on to maybe a different job or a different, even a different marriage, or you should be moving on different thinking or a different religion or something. And if you hold back on that and say, no, that would disrupt me, or you wouldn't even think it through, but you would decide to say no to life, I think that's where the soul gets wounded most. Your individuality comes from your soul, not from your head. It comes from allowing life to live through you, so you're open enough, you're the receiver.
Chapter 4, The Clouds. I have a lot of things to prove to myself. One is that I can live my life fearlessly. I have been speaking in front of people since I was 3.5 years old, reciting what we called at the time Easter pieces for the church. I still remember one of my first passages, Jesus rose on Easter day, hallelujah, hallelujah, all the angels did proclaim. The lady sitting in the front row, we called them sisters of the church, would say to my grandmother, Hattie Mae, this girl sure is a talking child. Eventually, I was invited to speak all of James Weldon Johnson's poetry from his book God's Trombones, 7 Negro Sermons in verse, in congregations all over Nashville. From then on, no matter the size of the stage or who was watching, I had no fear of public speaking. In fact, it was in many ways where I felt most myself. Another instance of the oak within the acorn. That is, until I got the call from Harvard. By this time, I'd been speaking for over 30 years, around the world, in stadiums filled with tens of thousands of people, and during television events watched by millions of people. But being asked to give the commencement speech for this 382-year-old Ivy League institution was yet another milestone. I mean, there aren't too many girls from rural Mississippi who can say they got to go to Harvard to talk. What an honor. And what pressure. I felt a lot of pressure. The kind of internal angst that makes you sit down at the computer to write, take one look at the empty screen, close the computer and say, I'll get to this in a little bit. Then worry about it some more, set a deadline to work on it again, and when the alarm goes off, find an excuse not to do it. You know how that goes. Usually, in times of uncertainty, my mantra is, when you don't know what to do, do nothing, and the answer will come. But I was not uncertain. Every part of me wanted to give this speech. I've also followed the guiding principle, doubt means don't. But again, this wasn't doubt. This was fear. Fear that I had nothing revelatory to teach these brilliant Harvard minds, that I had nothing to tell them that they hadn't heard before. And this fear manifested as procrastination, which resulted in guilt. Months later, during a conversation with the author, Stephen Pressfield, I was finally able to make sense of those feelings. Stephen said, the more important an activity is to your soul's evolution, the more resistance you will feel to it. He explained that no matter the dream, the shadow of resistance is inevitable. It's like the yin and yang. You can't have the dream without the shadow. So the more importance I placed on the Harvard speech, the stronger the resistance. This was a big aha for me. And it was incredibly comforting. It meant that there was no point in blaming myself for my anxiety because what I was experiencing was actually a spiritual law. The worries running around in my head were nothing more than the natural force of negativity at work, the shadow that lives in all of us, trying to convince us of our unworthiness. You're not good enough. What do you think you got to say to the kids at Harvard? Understanding this changed everything. It was as though a cloud had lifted. Stephen's theory was a totally new way of looking at fear. For every dream, there is automatically going to be resistance, but your sheer will and desire can be stronger than the shadow. You get to decide. You get to declare, I want this, and confront the fear head on. As you'll hear in the upcoming quotes and conversations, doubt, fear, and worry stem not only from the voices inside you. Resistance can also come from those who love you most. They might give you myriad reasons not to pursue your dream. But remember, although often well-intentioned, even your closest allies are usually operating with their own agenda, whether they're aware of it or not. As for my speech, I found my groove after I realized you don't need to have gone to Harvard to speak to Harvard graduates. I love my time in Cambridge, and I'm proud that I faced down those shadow beliefs. Fear is real. We've all experienced it. And it can be a powerful roadblock. The true meaning of courage is to be afraid and then, with your knees knocking and your heart racing, take the leap anyway. Ready. Set. Go. Listen to Iyanla Banzant's take on the importance of moving past your fears.
I'm fighting that part of me that says, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Don't do that. And there's a part of me that says, come on, we're going to do this. And then the other part says, don't you remember what happened last time? Oh, you're going to do that. You can't do it. It's in me. And there's a part of
me. So that's where the real battle is.
That's where the real battle is. That is where the crux and the core of trust comes in. Those two parts of us. The part of us that would rather stay broke and miserable, complaining, you know, living in the whatever, the mediocrity.
And why? Why? Because we're afraid?
Because we get to control it. I know how to be broke and poor and struggle and suffer and be angry. I know how to do that. You know, I got a degree. But when it comes to being open and vulnerable, because trust, the core ingredient of trust is vulnerability.
Yeah. Trust yourself. And I love what you say in here is that, you know, there isn't a person you can ask
in the world at some point where they didn't say, I just find it difficult to trust people.
Right.
But what you say, that's not really the issue.
No.
Learning to trust other people.
No.
The real issue is
trusting yourself. Trusting yourself that you're going to make the right choices, trusting yourself that you can hear that voice and follow it, trusting yourself.
That when people betray you, abandon you, don't acknowledge you, whatever, you will...
I'll be okay.
Yeah. You know, I love, too, when you say that when you live with trust and faith, truly live it, what everyone else says and does becomes irrelevant.
It really does. You don't even hear it. But then again, that means that you've got to be willing sometimes to stand alone.
Yep.
You've got to be willing to piss some people off. You've got to be willing to look different, sound different, be different. And those are risks that many of us are not willing to do because we don't understand God. You trust yourself by knowing who you are. You trust God by understanding God's nature.
Joel Osteen shares a deeply personal story.
Oprah, when my dad died, he'd pastored our church for 40 years. I'd grown up there. And so all of a sudden, I'm the new pastor. I felt like I was supposed to do it. I didn't know it'd be successful. Every thought told me, Joel, you hadn't been to seminary. You're going to get up there and look like a fool. What makes you think you can pastor the church after you've been behind the scenes for 17 years? But I got up there to minister, and I thought, I got to be like my dad. All these 6,000 people, they've come every week, you know, a lot of them for years and years. And if I don't teach like my dad and preach like my dad and use the same, I just felt like that it's not going
to
be right.
So the first sermon you did, you were trying to imitate your dad.
Yeah. I felt pressured to be him, not in a bad sense, because I love my dad. But I felt like I needed to be because that's what everybody expected of me. But then one day, about 3 or 4 months in, I realized I'm not good at being my dad. I'm not good at preaching his messages. He came from a Southern Baptist background. He's more fiery. And I thought, I'm laid back. I'm good at encouraging people, talking about life. And it's about 3 or 4 or 5 months in, I read a scripture. It said, David fulfilled his purpose for his generation. Whoa, and I felt like I heard something here that said, Joel, your dad fulfilled his purpose. Go be you. I think you can talk yourself into your dreams or you can talk yourself out of your dreams. I think that running your own race is probably another one of the biggest things that keeps people from their destiny.
I believe Mitch Albom found success because his intentions were pure.
Tuesdays with Maury was not supposed to be some kind of big book. It was a tiny little book that got turned down by most publishers I went to.
Because you wrote the book really just to help out Maury.
Just to pay his medical bills.
Just to pay his medical bills.
Yeah, that was it. In fact, if I hadn't had that as a purpose, honestly, Oprah, I would have given up trying because we had so many people tell us it's a bad idea, it's depressing, you can't write anything like that, you're a sports writer. I had one publisher tell me in the middle of while I was telling him what I thought was so significant about Maury, he said, let me stop you. We're not going to take this book. And honestly, I don't think you even know what a memoir is. Why don't you come back in 20 years and maybe you'll be old enough to write a good memoir. I remember leaving there and I thought, why can't they just say no? I mean, it's like, they have to like knock it down. I've actually heard from them down the pike and they were interested in something else that I was doing when I had some more success.
And you were kind enough not to remind them?
I did not remind them.
Oh, wow.
But I also didn't go with them.
And now, Tim's story.
We only have 24 hours in a day. So you have a choice to walk with wise people and stack up more wisdom, or you can become a companion of fools and your life will unravel. If I life coached you one-on-one, I would guarantee that some of your lost momentum has come with the people that you placed around your life. Because people can suck the life out of you. If you walk with the wise, you grow wise yourself.
Dr. Shefali Sabari.
I have adults in therapy in their 40s and 50s, terrified when they're facing bankruptcy or a divorce or life throws a curve at them because they believe they will be nothing. And they're so afraid to confront that emptiness. But little realizing that just beneath emptiness is the vast expanse of their spirit.
Crisis of confidence ultimately elevated India Arie to the life she envisioned for herself.
The first year I went to the Grammys, I was nominated for 7, and it was really out of the blue because I hadn't sold that. I had sold maybe 800,000 albums, mm-hmm. and I got nominated for 7 Grammys.
Whoa.
And so the show came, and I lost all of them. And it was this big conversation for ever, all over the radio for years. Yeah. But, you know, for the first 2 months, it was all over the radio and why and how could she, you know,
be nominated for 7 Grammys, right? And not win one.
It ended up being called a shutout.
Yeah.
And so a couple times in a couple of rap songs, I've heard people refer to it as the India RE. Yeah. What if you get India RE'd at the Grammys? Like, uh-huh. It's this thing. And I realized 2 things about that now. And one is that that really was God's way of giving me a breakthrough, because I was on everybody's lips all of a sudden because I lost. Everybody was still talking about me, and they had so much love for me and compassion about me. And then my album sales shot up. But all I felt was, maybe I'm not meant to have all of that. And, mm-hmm. You know, but...
Maybe I didn't deserve it.
Maybe I didn't. It didn't feel like deserve. Well, yeah, maybe I didn't deserve. At the time, it didn't feel like deserve. It just felt like maybe that's just not how I'm built. Maybe I wasn't built for that. When I first got those Grammy nominations, I had chest pains. I was having chest pains when I really should have been celebrating and enjoying. And I know this is going to sound simple, but I really feel this, that your self-worth is your job. It's your sacred space to cultivate. Because there's always going to be somebody who comes along and says, you're not thin enough, or your hair is not that enough, or your voice is not high enough, or you're not going to make it in the music industry because you don't sound like all the other. There's always going to be somebody who comes along and says something like that. But if you can remind yourself that they're wrong, mm-hmm. because you know you're on path, if you can just remind yourself. And one of the things I do now after all this healing work I've done is I sit in my journal or my meditation time and I say, what would I do about this thing, whatever it is? Sometimes it's an opportunity that I think I'm not ready for. Sometimes it's somebody telling me that I can't or I'm not worthy, you know, mm-hmm. of something. And I sit in my private space and I say, I really just play it all out. I can visualize it or write it. And I say, what would I do if I were, if I knew I was 100% worthy of this? What would I do?
What would I do if I were 100% worthy?
If I knew.
If I knew.
What would I do? Just what if?
There are so many ahas when I talk with Michael Bernard Beckwith. I get goosebumps.
So this is a shift that takes place where you're actually talking about the possibilities mm-hmm. more than you're talking about your issues.
Yeah.
You don't deny the issues. Bad things have happened to people. You're not denying that those things have happened.
But it's the energy that you give to it. That
yes.
is a definite, true fact. If you start talking about somebody or you're engaged in a conversation where you're gossiping, before long, you're spiraling down.
Energy goes into those lower frequencies.
Yep.
Doubt, worry, fear. Now you're in that sediment. Mm-hmm. You're in that dynamic. Mm-hmm. But if you start talking about possibility, even if you don't know how to get there, then your energy starts to go up. Mm-hmm. What if? You ask a what if question. What if all my needs were met? What would I be doing in my life? What if everything is really working together for my good? What if all the bad things that have happened in my life are leading me to activating some great potential in my experience? Mm-hmm. What if God really is on my side?
Yeah.
You ask a what if question and you start to notice little tiny miracles happening in your life. Mm-hmm.
Debbie Ford shares her insight.
The shadow is always fear-based, right? I don't want to be that. Mm-hmm. What we judge, I don't want to be that. I'll never be like my mother. You know, mm-hmm. people are always saying that, mm-hmm. or my father. Or it's always a push away. That's how we know. It's a judgment. Mm-hmm. It's when somebody says something to us and we have that jarring effect and it makes us angry. We know it's our shadow because otherwise we wouldn't care.
But isn't the ultimate shadow belief that I'm not good enough?
Well, I think that there's a couple of cores. Mm-hmm. I'm not good enough. I'm unlovable, mm-hmm. right? Another form of I'm not good enough is I'm unworthy. Mm-hmm. And I think women more than anybody mm-hmm. have that innately inside of them. So those are three very powerful shadow beliefs that birth all the other ones that come along. Mm-hmm. And if we understand it, we understand that it's not about hating these, which most people are fighting, right? They're resisting. I was just resisting this shadow called cancer, mm-hmm. you know, but it's about embracing. Like, why would I have this? And how could I use this? And I know you and I talked about it, I think 11 years ago, about how do you feel worthy enough? Mm-hmm. And how do we feel strong enough, no matter who we are? And I think because we're born with so many gifts that have been so suppressed mm-hmm. that we can't allow that real self. And if you can't allow the dark to exist, then you can't allow the light.
My profound conversation with Michael Singer remains a viewer favorite.
Now, why are we so afraid of change?
What basically happens is we've gone to the mind and said, I'm not okay. How does everything need to be for me to be okay? And then we have are devoted ourselves to try and create that situation. It doesn't work, but we don't know that yet. And so we try to create situations that we think will make us be okay. And when things start changing that don't match that model.
Yeah, we get scared.
We get scared because it looks like it's not going to work.
Okay, I love what you say, too. People don't realize that fear is a thing.
Yes.
Fear is a thing.
It's a thing.
It's just another object in the universe that you're capable of experiencing, and you can do one of two things with fear. You can
either push it away or you can let it go.
Yeah.
Right? You can either avoid it and be scared of it, mm-hmm. or you can let it pass right through. Fear comes up out of your heart. That's a very natural thing. It's human. All right? You are watching it. You see it. You have the right to relax, let it pass right through you. If you don't do that, you're going to try and fix it. You're going to try and control situations outside so you don't ever feel the fear. And it all starts to bother you. That's what it means. You'll fall. And eventually you'll lose your consciousness. You'll forget your whole purpose. And you'll just be scared. You just get scared.
You say the alternative is to decide not to fight with life. But that feels like just giving up and letting things take over.
Right. You don't do that in any way, shape, or form, right? Life is a natural unfolding of reality. You're supposed to harmonize and work with it. You don't give up and let it take over, right? It's like if you get on a horse and you're scared, you're not going to be a very good rider. Right? But that doesn't mean you let the horse go wherever they want. Mm-hmm. You learn how to interface and interact with life in a wholesome, participatory way. Fear doesn't let you do that. So letting go of fear is not letting go of life.
And now, Elizabeth Gilbert.
This was my victory in my battle. All my demons, all my monsters that I'd been carrying around forever, the light came through and I realized, they're not demons. They're not monsters. They're not dragons. I've been making them more grandiose than they are. They're just the orphaned parts of me. They're just the fearfulest, most young, terrified parts of me. They are scared to death, and they are throwing temper tantrums because of their fear. And now I have to tell them that it's going to be okay, and they will all go to sleep. I am the mother of all of these parts of me. And I remember just sort of in my mind ascending above them all and just saying, I love you, fear, and now you go to sleep. I love you, anger, you're part of me. Go to sleep, it's fine. I'm in charge now. I love you, shame, even you. Come into my heart, go to sleep. You're safe, I love you. I'm not leaving you. I can't, you're part of me, you're part of the family. You're never gonna be away from me. I love you, failure. Come into my heart, rest. You're so tired, you're so scared, you're just children, you don't know how the world works. I love all of you, I have space for all of you. And together, we're just gonna go forward now.
Chapter 5, The Map. All dreams start from the core. Unless you are in total alignment with whatever you envision, the dream will get derailed. Your intention has to be pure. How many times have you witnessed someone get close to achieving a goal, only to see it all suddenly fall apart? Or he or she does reach the top of the mountain, but can't hold on. Maybe you too have struggled with near misses and not quite realized dreams, yet are unable to pinpoint why. Self-sabotage can be a devastating cycle. I believe deeply in what Paulo Coelho so famously wrote in his seminal book, The Alchemist. When you want something, all the universe conspires in helping you to achieve it. Time and again, I've seen how the universe rises up to meet the vision that lives inside us. But just as often, I've seen dreams crushed. The variable between winning the race and faltering at the finish line lies with one of the guiding forces in my life. Intention. Before you embark on any quest, you must first articulate your vision. Set your course. It doesn't have to be a public or formal declaration, but it does need to be clear. particularly in today's climate where there is a palpable craving for meaning and authenticity. People can feel what's real and what's not. So if you want support for your idea, stand in what you hold sacred. Those who sense your truth will rise up. And most important, you must believe with your whole heart that you are capable of achieving your goal. If not, your path becomes murky and the goal stays out of reach. For me, the journey to open the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls was one of the most challenging and ultimately rewarding I've ever experienced. This was something I felt I'd been growing toward my entire life. I recognized myself in the face of each and every girl yearning to overcome the trauma of poverty and all that it encompassed. These strong, talented future leaders could see their way forward, but needed an environment in which to thrive. That's why, despite confronting formidable obstacles along the way, breaking ground on the 52-acre campus just outside Johannesburg, South Africa, was an important full circle for me. It's taken an enormous emotional and financial investment, but ever since the year 2002, when I shared with Nelson Mandela my hope of creating access to education for those who demonstrated promise and potential, my commitment to the school has never wavered. So you can imagine my surprise when I was asked during an interview about critics who said the school would not last. "They said that?" I asked the reporter. "Yes, in the beginning," she replied. My response to her was this: "People have no idea of my tenacity. Once I commit to something and I have a full-hearted desire to see it work, I can't imagine what it would take to make me quit." I held a vision for what this school could be, a place to build leaders and inspire greatness. I handpicked every sock, every shoe, every door, every book to honor the girls who would attend. The purity of that intention was aligned from my heart to my head. I had no other ulterior motive. This was about bringing the power of choice to the first generation of apartheid-free women in South Africa. That doesn't mean I didn't ask myself if it was worth it during some of the most difficult times. I certainly did wonder, but the answer that always came back was, yes, this is 1,000% worth it. I was convinced we could raise these girls to know for themselves what I've told them over and over again: you are not your circumstances, you are your possibilities. In this chapter, it's my hope that you will gain a greater understanding of how discovering your purpose begins with committing to your course. Whether you want to fulfill a long-held dream, find greater success in the career you've chosen, give more of yourself to others, or repair a broken relationship, you must first ask, why? What is the real intention? And then ask, how will I execute the action? The 10th anniversary of the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls was in 2017. To date, nearly 400 graduates have gone on to attend universities around the world. I set out to create a dream school where the brightest yet most vulnerable could find their voices and know for themselves that there is no bar. Their only limits are the ones they set. From day one, I told them, don't just break the ceiling, reach for what's beyond. As for the interview with the reporter who asked about naysayers, I went on to tell her, don't bet against me. You cannot defeat someone who knows who they truly are. I know who I am and why I'm doing this, so I would not bet against me. The moment you know with certainty that your intention is fully aligned with what you believe, all bets are off. You've already won. Here's Iyanla VanZant.
If you don't have a vision, you're going to be stuck in what you know. And the only thing you know is what you've already seen. But a vision that grows inside of you, a vision that wakes with you, sleeps with you, moves with you, a vision that you can tap into on your worst days, the vision will pull you forward. Who do you think you are? I love that one. Who do you think you are? Me? Affirm your vision. Clarify your vision. Know what you're doing, why you're doing it, and how you're doing it, day by day, moment by moment. And sometimes the how only shows up on a need-to-know basis. Don't wait for the how until you start pursuing your vision. You understand? Don't wait for the how. Sometimes you just have to walk blindly. But if you just do your vision every single day, putting one foot in front of the other, committed to your desires, being obedient, walking through your fears, the vision will unfold much grander than you could have ever even imagined or asked for.
Here's Gabrielle Bernstein.
I want everyone to know that everyone is entitled to miracles, that everyone is. Miracles occur naturally, and when they're not occurring, something has gone wrong. We have the capacity to lose the weight. We have the capacity to earn the money. We have the capacity to live a far greater life than we perceive we do. But we have to make that decision. We have to exercise that free will and make that conscious choice.
I truly believe there would be no super soul without Gary Zukav.
All souls have the capacity to be great souls. And your job and my job while we are in the Earth School is to align our personalities with our souls. And we do that by becoming the personality that has the same intentions of the soul, harmony and cooperation and sharing and reverence for life. Suppose, for example, you're a mother and you've got three children. You're in overwhelm a lot.
Right.
And one of the children in particular is a bit demanding.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have a husband, and he's been working away all day, away from home. He may or may not be sympathetic or even appreciative of how much work it is to be at home with three children and to prepare for him coming home. So you can find yourself overwhelmed. You can find yourself frustrated or exasperated by the child that's most demanding. You can find yourself angry at your husband. What do you do? This is exactly the time that you have the opportunity to create authentic power. And here's how you do it. Go inside.
Go inside.
That's the first step. That is developing emotional awareness. The second step, and once you can do this, you put yourself in a very powerful position. Because just by turning inward instead of acting in the moment, you have created a little gap mm-hmm. between the impulse and the action.
Mm-hmm.
And into that space, you can inject consciousness. Into that space, you can do something you couldn't have done before. Choose
mm-hmm.
consciously.
Yeah.
You can decide, I am going to say this to my husband. He's insensitive and I'm sick and tired of him being sensitive.
Or I'm not.
Or I'm going instead to act from the most loving part of my personality that I can reach for in that moment.
I hear.
And it may be that the most loving part of your personality you can reach for is just not to say anything.
Mm.
But you have then changed your universe.
Yes.
It's your choice. And you make the choice every time you choose an intention. When you choose an intention of love, instead of an intention of fear.
And that is the spiritual journey.
That is the spiritual journey. That is the spiritual path.
Brené Brown shares how she set the intention for her family.
So can you read the Parenting Manifesto?
I can.
Yes.
Above all else, I want you to know that you are loved and lovable. You will learn this from my words and my actions. The lessons on love are in how I treat you and how I treat myself. I want you to engage with the world from a place of worthiness. You will learn that you are worthy of love, belonging, and joy every time you see me practice self-compassion and embrace
yes.
my own imperfections.
Yes.
We will practice courage in our family by showing up, letting ourselves be seen, and honoring vulnerability. We'll share our stories of struggle and strength. There will always be room in our home for both. We will teach you compassion by practicing compassion with ourselves first, then with each other. I want you to know joy, so together we'll practice gratitude. I want you to feel joy, so together we'll learn how to be vulnerable. Together we'll cry and face fear and grief. I will want to take away your pain, but instead I will sit with you and teach you how to feel it.
Oh, I'm going to cry right now. We all want a mother like that and a dad. Steve, hello.
We will laugh and sing and dance and create. We will always have permission to be ourselves with each other, no matter what. You will always belong here. Okay. As you begin your wholehearted journey, the greatest gift that I can give to you is to live in love with my whole heart and to dare greatly. I will not teach or love or show you anything perfectly, but I will let you see me, and I will always hold sacred the gift of seeing you, truly, deeply seeing you.
I just wish everybody could live by those words, really.
Me too. That's
how you change the world.
I believe it.
Stephen Colbert shares how he set the intention for his show.
Spike Jones, the director and pretty good actor, too, he came by. He just said, do you need any help starting your show? And I'm like, sure, let's talk. So he just came by and he interviewed me 6 months before my show went on the air about what I wanted the show to be. And after we've been on the air for a while, and he actually sent it to me this past year, he sent those notes back to me to say, I want to remind you what your intention was. And one of the things he said that he sort of circled or pointed out in it was, I don't know how to do a nightly comedy show that's also about love. But I'd like it in some way to be about love. And there's so many different ways to express that, I suppose. And that's always...
That's what you had said.
That's what I said to him in the interview, which he showed back to me as a reminder.
I think it's interesting that you set an intention for it. Yeah.
Yes.
I live through that.
And then you start and you don't know how to find it, and that gives you all kinds of
But
jitters.
Wasn't that helpful? Not knowing the way helped you find the way.
Right, because anything is possible, and it's always going to be painful to make a transition or a change like that.
But you know, the hope for love. Yeah.
The hope for love. And I think now we found is that I love my country, I love science, I love facts. I love people regardless of their race or their gender identity. And the challenge now is to love the people who don't seem to have that value in their heart, or at least how it's politically expressed. I don't know what's in their heart. Even the people I disagree most with, if I sat down and had this conversation with them, we might leave the conversation hand in hand.
David Brooks helps us understand what it means to stand by your core values.
To me, there's a central piece of us that makes decisions. And every time you make a decision or have an experience, you turn that core piece of yourself into something slightly more elevated or something more degraded. And if you make disciplined choices, you slowly engrave a certain set of habits and dispositions inside that core piece. And if you make fragmented decisions, you make that core piece a little degraded. And when I look at people with character, what they have is consistency over time.
Here's Vice President Joe Biden.
I think the reason people abuse power is that they, in fact, are seduced by the notion that they are so self-important, that they really matter, when in fact it is not usually the case. The leaders I've observed who are the best are the ones who have courage to take a chance, be willing to lose on principle, and two, are self-aware. They understand their strengths and they understand their weaknesses. They play to their strengths and they try to shore up their weaknesses. And the people who don't do that are the people who aren't self-aware enough to know what they're, because most of the time that abuse ends up in their downfall as well.
LinkedIn CEO Jeff Weiner shares his vision for success.
Most organizations traditionally are based on hierarchical structures.
Yeah.
And you have someone at the top, and that someone at the top is not necessarily leading the way I would define leading. They're managing.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, there's a fundamental difference. So management is telling somebody what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Leadership is inspiring them to do it.
Yeah.
And inspiration, for me, comes from three areas, three places. It's the clarity of one's vision, the courage of one's conviction, and the ability to effectively communicate both of those things.
Marianne Williamson suggests a powerful shift in energy.
I always say blast them with love before you get there. I always talk about how before you go into the meeting, just blast everybody with love. So if you're going to an audition, if you're going to an interview for a job, you know, the
blast
world.
Blast them with love.
Right, because if you have the thought, oh, my God, I need this job and I really need it and I hope they'll like me, all of that actually limits your capacity
to
shine.
The energy of desperation shows.
In the ways that actually might promote they're wanting you to work for their company. So if you instead say, the only thing going on here is I'm going to bless that person. They're here to bless me. I don't know if I'm supposed to get that job. My only agenda is that God's will be done, which is the downloading of the file.
The file is called God's will be done.
Right.
Let's listen to Daniel Pink.
I believe that we're here for a purpose. I think that what gives people satisfaction is doing something that's about a cause larger than themselves. I say, do something that's hard to outsource and hard to automate. But then ultimately, it's really about following your intrinsic motivation. Doing it is sort of figuring out your purpose. What are you here to do? What are you uniquely good at? And then I would actually add to that the importance of doing it persistently, being dogged. I think there are massive returns to doggedness.
Carol Bayer-Sager sets the tone for her music.
I've always believed in my heart that the best songs, the ones that resonate in my soul and therefore go out into the world and resonate in other people's, don't come from us, they come through us. And I always say a little prayer before I go into my music room. And it's a sort of a prayer of intention, you know, of please let me bring forth something, help me, that will help heal.
And now, Cheryl Strayed.
You know, one of the most important lessons I learned through the success of Wild is that it was such an affirmation that if you take that risk, if you take that chance, if you tell that the truest, hardest, deepest story you have within you, you're not going to step into the light and find that you're there alone, that you're going to be surrounded by people who are there with you.
And say, me too.
Saying, me too.
Me too.
And when you take that, essentially you're risking vulnerability, you're risking showing your truest nature.
Here's Michael Bernard Beckwith.
Potential is always bigger than the problem. Your potential is infinite and is always bigger than whatever problem you're going through. So when you begin to have a vision.
Oh, this is good. I'm going to shout in a minute. This is really good. Amen.
You begin to have a vision about the possibility. You start to be pulled by it. And then once you really sincerely embrace it, and your life begins to be, okay, when I wake up this morning, I'm going to walk in the direction of my purpose. Now, it doesn't mean you're not going to have challenges.
Of course.
We're not praying to live a challenge-free life. We're praying that the challenges that come activate latent potential. Begin to talk about it. Begin to write it down. Doesn't mean you talk to everybody because everyone is not trustworthy.
That's right.
You talk to selected friends.
About it.
About it. You talk to it.
Uh-huh.
You actually talk to the vision. Talk to the possibility. Talk to love. You talk to peace. You talk to prosperity. I see you everywhere. I see you, prosperity, in the lawn. And I see you everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You talk to it. And then after a while, you're talking from it.
Here's Janet Mock on Following Her Truth.
So when I was in the second grade, and we were told, what do you want to be when you grow up?
And you said secretary.
I said secretary. Because to me, from what I learned in culture, that's what women did. Women were, you know, they assisted men in their dreams. And then I went home with a note to my father from my teacher, and I thought it was going to praise me. And instead, it was basically like, I think this is something you should be paying more attention to. And that just triggered my father on so many levels. His own insecurities about
me. It triggered your father because now your father recognizes that not only do I see it, I see the femininity in my son, but now his own teacher is now sending me a note home saying, take note of this. So what happened?
And so everyone basically gets on board that what we need to all do is to fix this. How do we get this out of this child? And so my father started lecturing me. It was my first lecture from my father about the way I should act in the world, the way that I should be.
Boys do this and girls
do that.
And boys are not secretaries.
No, boys are not secretaries. Boys are football players. They're Dallas Cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do.
Mm-hmm. So then did you try to conform for them?
I started compromising.
But this is what's amazing to me is that at 15 years old, you made a decision after meeting your friend Wendy that you were going to go to school as a girl, that you basically transitioned in your own heart and that you had the courage to step out and do that at 15 years old.
Yeah. I come back after ninth grade and I was like, I'm not going to present in a way that makes anyone else comfortable. I'm going to present in a way that makes me comfortable. And so I had just been elected class treasurer. And so I stand on that stage the first day of school, our sophomore class, and I say, hello, everyone. I'm Janet.
And did everyone just accept it?
I wouldn't say accepted it. I think a lot of people tolerated it.
I think that's pretty amazing.
And now Goldie Hawn on Choosing Happiness.
At 11 years old, I made a very definitive decision. And my decision was that I wanted to be happy. Above and beyond anything I ever did in my life, that I wanted to be happy. But I remember these grown-ups coming to me and saying, do you want to be a movie star when you grow up? Do you want to be a dancer? Do you want to be a professional dancer when you grow up? What do you want to be? And I would say, happy. And they would look at me really weird. No, we said, what do you want to be? And I said, I want to be happy. That's really all I wanted. Talk about an intention. That's a better intention than a white picket fence.
Chapter 6, The Road. Find your lane. Make space for the flow to show itself. Follow the natural rhythm of your life, and you will discover a force far greater than your own. If there's anyone who has fearlessly lived the highest, truest expression of herself, it is the feminist icon Gloria Steinem. Without the brazen conviction of Gloria and those who stood shoulder to shoulder with her in the fight for gender equality, I know the opportunities available to all of us women would not exist. Gloria is, without a doubt, a mighty force. The last time the two of us spoke, she offered her sage perspective on how she's moved through life with such razor-sharp clarity. Gloria told me she lives in what she calls a constant on-the-road state of mind. This way of thinking, she says, reminds her to stay open to learning, because travel brings people out of their heads and into their hearts, and offers the promise of expanding the truth. Spiritually, the on-the-road philosophy keeps Gloria in the moment, feeling, in her words, boundaryless, spontaneous, and at one with everything. She compared her approach to a bird in flight, riding on a current, perpetually focused on forward motion, at all times checking the direction of the wind, yet open to all possibilities. Birds find their flow, she told me, like surfers catch their wave. Gloria changed the course of history by staying present and moving with the cadence of the moment. For me, that on-the-road philosophy is the definition of the word flow. It means first identifying and then trusting your own current, one that is in complete alignment with your life. You might have heard athletes, artists, or musicians describe flow as being in the zone. They use phrases such as tunnel vision, complete calm, or ultra focus. Some liken it to a spiritual experience, a state of consciousness in which time feels like it's slowed down or completely fallen away. Most of us have been in the zone at some point in our own lives. It's that exhilarating stretch where everything seems to fall into place. The road ahead is clear, open, and smooth. So then what causes us to get off track or feel like we're suddenly hitting every bump along the way? Basketball legend LeBron James is considered one of the most intensely focused competitors ever to play the game. I once asked LeBron, what could possibly cause an MVP like him to lose his rhythm on the court? His response, I get off my game when I start playing for others rather than playing for myself. Yes. This is a universal truth. We fall off course the minute our intention shifts from following our heart to responding to what we think others believe. All of a sudden, life feels complicated. That's because you've altered your efforts in the hope of impressing someone else. The goal is to get back to living for yourself, to get back to your flow. And that is not a selfish thing. It's an honorable thing. Like Gloria Steinem, you too have the power to seek the highest, truest expression of yourself. The critical word is true, not just speaking the truth, being your truth. How can you embody the most authentic version of you? The lessons in this chapter are geared toward how, after setting your course, you allow life to carry you. I have learned that creating your own purpose-filled momentum is possible only when you give yourself the space, moment to moment, to focus on the next right choice. And despite the inevitable distractions, when you find that sweet spot, living your truth takes on a breathtaking level of intensity. That is the brilliance of flow. Let's begin with Deepak Chopra.
Everybody is looking for the future. And they're never in the present. Mm-hmm. So when they arrive at the future, it's not there for them because they're not present for it. So you get the idea that this is the moment that you have, it's the only moment that you have, then you live in the present and you move with the flow because this is the point of arrival right now.
Here's Barbara Brown Taylor.
We'd like life to be a train. You know, you get on, pick your destination and get off. And it turns out to be a sailboat. And every day you have to see where the wind is and check the currents and see if there's anybody else on the boat with you who can help out. But it's a sailboat ride. And the weather changes and the currents change and the wind changes. It's not a train ride. If I'm on a journey, it's all about the destination. I'm not there yet. I'll be there one day. The train will pull into the station. But I'm really interested in the walking. I'm really interested in the companion on the road. I'm really interested in where I'm standing right now. So I have no argument with greatness. But if that becomes an excuse for dismissing my life now because I haven't found that great purpose yet, that's a waste of a day, if not a life.
Shonda Rhimes describes the pure joy she finds in her work.
Writing is your truth, would you say?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Although I always say that I make stuff up for a living, and yet that's my truth.
That's your truth. So tell me what happens. We've all heard about athletes having a zone. Mm-hmm. Is it a zone for you too?
I call it the hum.
The hum.
The hum. It's like I get this hum in my head where I feel like I could write forever.
Like, hum?
Yeah, almost, yeah. Like a frequency, basically.
Wow.
Where you go from sort of exertion to, I don't know, exaltation. Where it feels, there's just an endless joy for me. Where I feel like I could write for the rest of my life. And I lose time, and my assistant has to come in and say, it's been 5 hours. You have to stop now because of this or that. It's really lovely. It's a real, true happiness. It's very pure for me.
Wow. It's a spiritual practice.
Yeah, it is.
And here, Jay-Z on finding his rhythm.
Flow is just becoming one with the music. You find some place inside the music that you tuck in, and you don't get in the way of the groove. You insert yourself in the song as an instrument. You're just part of the track. You're no different than the horn or the snare or the bass or the hi-hat. You found the place in that track to tuck in. You just don't disturb the groove where it's just smooth and it just flows. I love having that experience.
Here's Eckhart Tolle.
So first of all, the most important thing to realize is in any situation, whether it's to do with a collective, political situation, personal situation. In any situation, what is primary is your state of consciousness, the state of consciousness with which you face that situation.
What's the way forward?
The way forward is for the individual to take responsibility, to remember that the most important thing is not what's happening out there, that what is primary is my, I'm saying now, my state of consciousness at this moment is primary. That determines what form the future will take. So, important thing to realize is what happens to you is much less important than how you respond to what happens. That determines your life. It's not the things that happen to you that determines your life. Ultimately, it's how do I respond to what happens, and that is also your area of freedom. You can choose to respond consciously to what happens. Then you're not at the mercy of what happens to you.
Here's Joel Osteen.
Well, I think you can be satisfied knowing this. If I'm doing my best, if I'm giving it my all, if I'm pursuing my dreams, if I'm growing, then I got to believe my time is coming. In the meantime, I think when we're content, we're showing God that we're honoring God. If you don't get happy where you are, you probably won't get to where you want to be. And so I think you got to come back and say, okay, you know what? I'm not going on the big vacation yet, but I'm going to be faithful right where I am. I'm going to make good choices. I'm going to develop my gifts. And I believe God will open up some of those doors.
People think, well, if I'm content, it means that I'm okay.
Yeah, yeah. You're saying, God, hey, you know what, God, I want to do something greater with my life, or I want to pay this house off, or I want to start this business. But right now, I'm not going to be discontent where I am.
Yeah, it means not resisting.
Exactly.
And now, Brother David Steindl-Ross.
So let's start right there, because I think that what you just said
is the key that unlocks the path to a successful life, and that is trust life.
That is the beginning.
That is the beginning, right? Isn't that the foundation?
That's the foundation of everything.
Yeah. To come to a common hope. And I love how you define hope.
I think hope is something very different from our hopes.
I think that's so
important.
Because
the hopes are always something that we can imagine.
Right.
You can't hope for it unless you can imagine it. But hope, in this truly spiritual sense, is openness for surprise. For that which you cannot imagine.
The real hope, with the capital H.
That's right.
Yes.
And if you trust life, it will surprise you, and it will always give you good things.
Chapter 7, The Climb. Funny thing about a mountain. It always looks easier to climb when you're at the foot of it. In 2012, I had the honor of interviewing Valerie Simpson just after she'd lost her husband of 38 years, Nick Ashford. Better known as the legendary songwriting duo Ashford and Simpson, they had a four-decade musical partnership that produced some of the most memorable hits ever to come out of Motown. During our emotional conversation, Valerie shared the real story behind one of their greatest songs, Ain't No Mountain High Enough. Sing along if you'd like. We all know the words. Ain't no mountain high enough. Ain't no valley low enough. Ain't no river wide enough to keep me from getting to you, babe. Well, most people think of these as enduring words of love, expressing the deepest form of devotion. But as we talked, Valerie told me that when Nick originally wrote the lyrics, he was referring to his goal to one day write songs professionally. At the time, Nick was an unknown musician living in New York City, hoping to be discovered. While looking up at the skyscrapers towering above him, he came up with the phrase, "Ain't no mountain high enough," to convey just how determined he was that nothing was going to keep him from his dream. No wind, no rain, or winter's cold can stop me, babe, 'cause you are my goal. And he was right. Ain't No Mountain High Enough now holds a place in the Grammy Hall of Fame. I've always thought a mountain is a magnificent metaphor for life. From a distance, the ascent looks clear and smooth, but once you actually set out for the summit, you discover unexpected valleys and precarious ridges along the way. If your internal compass isn't set to keep climbing, every stumble will give you an excuse to turn back. Over the years, there have absolutely been times when I've found myself climbing a steep, rocky road. Earlier, I shared the fears I struggled with when I was invited to give the commencement address at Harvard in 2013. I know my trepidation might seem surprising given the general perception of my career. After 25 years on a number one show, I had by most standards reached the summit. However, it just so happened that when Harvard's then president, Drew Faust, called with her once-in-a-lifetime offer, I was in the midst of one of the biggest climbs of my life. I'd even started calling this new endeavor my Kilimanjaro. And in this particular instance, it seemed the higher I hiked, the trickier the terrain. At the time, I said I was getting my butt kicked in the news over the way OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network, was, quote, struggling, as it was often reported. It felt like everywhere I looked, critics were taking me to task for OWN's performance. One of the toughest headlines announced, "Oprah Winfrey isn't quite holding her own." That one, I gotta tell you, stung. I'd enjoyed a long stretch at the top and was proud to be known as a powerful businesswoman. And now it felt like every decision I made ended up on the nightly news crawl. And so when Harvard reached out, all I could think was, what can I teach about success when I've stopped succeeding? It was a frustrating time. And to be frank, I was embarrassed. At one point, while I was in the shower, I was deliberating what to do. It's not a myth that some people make their best decisions in the shower. There really is something about the warm spray and lack of distraction that helps crystallize your thoughts. And indeed, as the water cascaded down and I thought about that mountain metaphor, I decided I would immediately stop calling the experience of building my own network anything but a privilege. I mean, really. I told myself, who gets to do this? It's the honor of a lifetime. If you think about it, people all over the world dream of climbing Kilimanjaro. The words to an old hymn started playing in my head. Trouble don't last always. I got out of the shower and thought, this too shall pass, and I will be the better for it. One of my favorite lessons from Joel Osteen is, what follows I am is what we're inviting into our life. Meaning when you use phrases like, I am exhausted, or I am overwhelmed, you are inviting exactly that kind of energy into your life. The moment I shifted my perspective from, I am struggling, to, I am honored, my climb was transformed from an arduous trek into a still challenging, but now stimulating adventure. And my entire outlook changed. Ever since that time, whenever I've encountered a disruption, rather than allowing it to rattle me, I ask myself one of the most meaningful and productive questions there is. What is this here to teach me? Today, OWN continues to evolve. Every day brings a new teachable moment, and I look back on each step of the journey with gratitude. The insights I hope you will embrace in this chapter reflect the knowledge I try to impart to my girls in South Africa as they consider any worthwhile pursuit. There will always be setbacks, I say. What you're experiencing is a detour. It's not the end of the road. You've got to be prepared to fail up. Most important, I teach the girls that everything that's happening to them is a means to help them evolve into who they are meant to become. Nothing is ever wasted or out of order. So when their will is being tested and all seems lost, I advise them to stop, get still, and listen. Their heart will tell them the next right step. And once they figure it out, it's time to look around and ask themselves, who is standing with me in the gap? Because what I discovered long ago is that when life is treating you well and it seems you can't go wrong, there will always be people who want to ride with you in the limo. But what you really want are the people who will take the bus with you when the limo breaks down. As you make your way up your mountains, no matter how steep the climb, remember the words of Nick Ashford. If you need me, call me, no matter where you are, no matter how far. Don't worry, baby. Just call my name. I'll be there in a hurry. You don't have to worry because, baby, there ain't no mountain high enough. Your Kilimanjaro awaits. Here's a bit of my conversation with Eckhart Tolle.
From a higher perspective, being challenged is a good thing. Let's look at the nature of challenges. If you look at your own life or anybody's life, you may find that one way or another, obstacles seem to arise almost continuously in the form of difficult people, difficult situations. Some people have the perception that they're being sabotaged by life all the time. People resent being challenged by life. They think challenges should not exist. But at some point you realize that the world isn't here to make you happy. It can't do that.
It's sort of like human evolution, where you say it's not linear. You take two steps forward in your own life and a step backwards. And then the further back you go, the more of a bounce you have to move forward, right?
Yes, we definitely have evolved in consciousness, but it does not go in a straight line upward. You regress, and then you go forward a bit more. It goes in cycles. But that is a necessary part of the evolution. So we need the crisis. Humans don't grow except through facing the challenges and crises. So there are two levels of truth. One is to see the craziness of what's happening now. And another is to see from a higher perspective to what's happening now is part of the evolution. The ego is coming up. Is manifesting.
It needs to break down.
Yes.
So that something else can break through.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Here's Stephen Colbert.
Well, my mother used to say that in hardships in your life, try to look at this moment in the light of eternity. You know, let's try to see this how God might see it. If it's good or bad, any hardship or victory, with humility, with acceptance, and with love. So, and you can't love something until you can accept it.
Here's Vice President Joe Biden.
My mother used to say, and I thought it was so cruel at one point, especially when I lost my wife and daughter and we walked out of the hospital, they'd a tractor trailer broadside him and killed him, and my two sons were badly injured. And she said, Joey, grab my hand, she said, out of everything horrible, something good will come if you look hard enough for it. But that was my mother's notion. We were taught just to get up. When you get knocked down, just get up and move forward. And talk about how, you know, so many people without the kind of help that I had do it every day. Right today, there's somebody who's gone through something significantly worse than me, and they have nobody behind them, and they're getting up and they're moving. And it gives me such overwhelming confidence in people, the ability to absorb pain and the spiritual reassurance that comes from knowing they're still a part of you.
Father Richard Rohr on the extraordinary beauty that grows from pain, if you allow it.
We each create our private salvation project, our private, what will make me wonderful, what will make me look beautiful and be admired. Every time you have to let go of that in its present form and reshape it, it's dying. It's, darn, I based my life on that, you know? I based my life on looking good or being a priest or whatever.
Or being married, and now that's falling apart.
That's
I have a friend who's going through divorce who said, you have to relearn a new normal.
But the old normal has to fall apart. That's dying.
That's right.
And you never go there voluntarily. You fall.
This is a psychological dying we're talking about.
Yes, it will be experienced psychologically.
Yes.
That's right.
When you go through a divorce and then first you are fighting it and you think it's the worst thing that could ever happen to you.
Yes.
And then you come out the other side of it and you feel a greater sense of freedom and a closer to your true self.
Might take you 5 years to get there.
Might take you
But you wake up one day and say, my God, this is much better.
Or you lose your job.
Yeah, lose your job
or you
lose
get
your,
sick.
Your reputation or your money.
Yeah.
Or your child dies. You know, all of those immense tragedies. Yeah. That's the way the self expands. I'm sorry to say it's true. It's all what you do with suffering. If you don't transform your suffering, Oprah, I always say you will transmit it. With 100% certitude, you will transmit your suffering to your family, your neighbors, your country. Yeah.
And now, here's Rob Bell.
We always talk about marriage as a creative act. You're creating something new in the world. Mm-hmm. And for many people, it becomes heavy. It becomes, let's just try to stay together, duty, obligation, as opposed to, we get to make something with this life. Mm-hmm. And the two of us get to go on an adventure and create something new. So every problem becomes not, oh my word, are we gonna make it? But, well, look what came down the road today. I wonder what this will produce. Mm-hmm. I wonder what we'll learn through this. Mm-hmm. It's like a shift in how you view life and life together. Isn't it an adventure in which you actually get to create and co-create a life?
Alanis Morissette shares her greatest lesson.
I thought that all would be helped and healed and soothed by fame.
Because when I get famous, yes.
Then I will be less lonely, and
yes.
I will be understood, and I will be loved, and that love will go in and heal any of the broken parts.
And the truth is, there's no difference between fame or when I get thin, or when I get rich, or
yeah.
when I
when
meet
I
the right
job.
Guy,
yes.
when I get the job,
when I
get
babies.
That car, when
yeah.
I get babies,
yeah.
then I will be...
When I retire.
When I retire,
yeah.
then I will be happy, I will be healed, I will be... And
Everything
it's the same
will be
thing.
Okay, yes.
Everything will be okay.
Yes, as though somehow we as humans could be exempt from pain. You know, one of the big lessons I've learned over the last little while has been that if I can become comfortable with pain, which is different than suffering.
Yes.
If I can become comfortable with pain as just an indication, and it's potentially a daily thing, in my case it often is, mm-hmm. then there won't be my living in the future all the time. That one day if and when I'll be happy.
And now, Cheryl Strayed.
Well, how long do we hold on to this old idea? Mm. I was going to do this job, or I was going to go to this school, or I was going to be married to this person.
Yeah.
And it doesn't serve us anymore. And you know where that came from is I was asked to write a letter to my 20-something self. And that's one of the things I told my younger self, is that it was okay to rewrite my story from time to time. And not only okay, but necessary. Sometimes you do have to see things through, even though they don't cause you joy. But sometimes you need to say, you know what? I'm not going to surrender my joy. Yeah. I'm not going to be this thing anymore. I'm going to be this other thing.
Here's Tracy Jackson.
Many times when you try to change, there are a whole circle of people who actually liked you better the old way.
You know, you develop languages with people. And you develop patterns of behavior, which is, I'm the dysfunctional one, you're the functional one, I'm the one in control, you're the one who's a little bit crazy, I'm always depressed, whatever it may be. And when you change that, all of a sudden their role in your life is put into question.
Yeah.
And they start having to question their own behavior,
That's right.
Which a lot of people don't like to do when it's forced on them.
Listen as I ask Tracy McMillan one of my favorite questions.
What's the lesson that's taken you the longest to learn?
I'd say the lesson that took me the longest to learn is compassion, right? For myself. Because I think I used to be very hard on myself. I thought I was supposed to know things before it was possible to know them. The truth is that everything we're doing, that's our life's work. My life's work is to learn how to love better. My life's work is to learn how to put light in places where it's dark.
Here's Cindy Crawford on her shift.
The idea of getting older is daunting and intimidating and not that fun, really. But recently I shifted to, I have the privilege of getting older. And I really like that because it's really easy to spin off into the negative as opposed to, aren't we lucky that we're here, that we get to get older? I think it's a lot easier to see yourself getting older if you're happy in your life and if you're doing meaningful work and you are contributing to life in a way that makes you feel good about yourself.
Here's insight from John Bon Jovi.
Any time that you think you've hit the top of the mountain, the truth of the matter is you just reached another mountain and it's there to climb over again. So I made sure that I learned that early on because had I accepted at 21 years old that a record deal was the top of the hill, that boy certainly couldn't talk to who I am now. Each step along the way is just a life's lesson in humility. And it gives you the ammunition to go on and be excited about the next day.
Here's Joel Osteen.
I don't think we realize what we're inviting into our life. You say, I am tired, I am frustrated, I am lonely. I think you're inviting more of that in that. So the principle is to turn it around, invite what you want into your life. I think there's a balance to it. And I don't think you're denying the facts. Otherwise, hey, well, I'm just hiding my head in the sand. It's not so much that. It's just not magnifying the negative. Like I talk about, I am a masterpiece. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. I am strong. I am talented. I think that is speaking to the core of what God's put in each one of us, that He has equipped us, He's empowered us, we have what we need to fulfill our destiny. But I do think that we have to bring it out. And you can't bring it out being against yourself.
Chapter 8, The Give. My life's goal is to be of service to a greater good. Wherever that true calling takes me, I've always been willing to go. My spiritual queen mother, the great Maya Angelou, was for me the ultimate teacher. Only Maya had the ability to reduce me to my 7-year-old self simply by the way she greeted me. "Hello, you darling girl," she would say at the start of every conversation. Her emails always set a loving tone, opening with, "Oh, dearie, oh." I'll never forget the first time she shared with me what would later become a much beloved refrain. People may not remember what you did or what you said, but they will always remember how you made them feel. What her words so brilliantly remind us is that every single moment is an opportunity to be of service to another human being. That is what I hope will be your takeaway from this chapter. I'm not referring just to volunteering or contributing to a cause, though those are wonderful, worthwhile activities that strengthen us. What I'm talking about is committing decision by decision to a sustained, heartfelt, compassionate approach to life. We are more alike than we are different, Maya used to say. Imagine what would happen if two people with opposing views came together to inform each other from a position of wanting to be of service. If you're caught in the deluge of negativity and vitriol that we're bombarded with on a daily basis, this would seem a nearly impossible idea, but I believe we're closer to reconnecting than we realize. When I accepted the Cecil B. DeMille Award at the 2018 Golden Globes, my speech caused a bit of a stir. It was not my intention to spark talk of a presidential campaign, but I can tell you why I believe that speech resonated with so many people. In my conversations with men and women from many walks of life, I felt a growing shift, a mutual yearning on all sides for a different way of envisioning the world. There is an eagerness rising within all of us to bridge our divides, to bring an end to vicious attacks on those whose viewpoints differ from ours, and to focus on elevating humanity. What I was trying to express in my speech was that all humans have value and a voice, and I consider it my purpose here on Earth to celebrate and validate both. The sheer volume of reaction to what I said at the Golden Globes is a direct testament to the fact that millions of us are ready to seek out and stand up for what's good, right, and just in our world. Maya once told me that my legacy will be every person whose life was touched by my being here. I believe the same is true for all of us. When it comes down to it, life can be measured in exchanges of energy, positive or negative. What is the energy you choose to bring to the world? Positive exchanges multiply and grow. That's why giving on any level feels so great. You are creating an actual force for good. Most people wait to assess their legacy until their second or third act of life, when there's time to sit back and reflect. But what if, right now, you began to structure your decisions based on how you want to be remembered rather than on what you believe you still need to accomplish? What I'm suggesting is that you don't wait until you're sitting on your porch in your rocking chair to evaluate the character of your actions. Ask yourself today, in the middle of your complicated, demanding, chaotic life, what do I want my legacy to be? And then start living from that intention. As Maya always said, when you know, teach. When you get, give. Let's begin with the beautiful words of Mark Nepo.
What do you want to be your legacy, or what will be your legacy?
I would want my legacy to be that what matters moves through me the way air moves and wind moves through a window to refresh another.
Brian Stevenson has dedicated his life in service of others.
Often we measure how we're doing in life by how much money we make or how many people know our name and all these other kinds of metrics, how many people respect us. I think there's another way of measuring how you're doing by how many stones you catch, by how often you actually position yourself to help those who need help. There is something redemptive, powerful, transformative about catching the stones that people throw at each other unfairly. We run from problems, most of us, but sometimes we have to run to the problem.
Listen to the wisdom of Thich Nhat Hanh.
Deep listening is the kind of listening that can help relieve the suffering of the other person. We can call it compassionate listening. You listen with only one purpose, help him or her to empty his heart. And if you remember that you are helping him or her to suffer less, and then even if he say things full of wrong perceptions, full of bitterness, you are still capable to continue to listen with compassion. Because you know that listening like that, with compassion, you give him or her a chance to suffer less. If you want to help him or her to correct his perception, and then you wait for another time, but for the time being, you just listen with compassion and help him or her to suffer less. And 1 hour like that can bring transformation and healing.
Here's U.S. Representative John Lewis.
During the Freedom Rides, or during the sit-ins, during my efforts in Mississippi around the vote, or working in Selma, I never, ever thought about giving up and saying this is too much. I never thought about dropping out. You come to that point where you say, I got to go on and see what the end going to be. You have to. You have to get out there and push and pull to try to make things better for the generation yet unborn. Each one of us has the ability to resist, not to be quiet. We have to be brave. We have to be bold. We have to use our constitutional rights. If it means a march, a silent walk, a sit-in, a sit-down, or maybe signing a petition, writing a letter of voting, we have to be engaged, all of us, as members of the human family, as citizens of this country. There are forces that want to take us back to another place, and we're saying we're not going back. We've come too far. We made too much progress to stop now or to turn around. That's why I feel it is part of my obligation, my mission, or mandate to reach as many young people as possible. The fight is not over. We have to continue to fight. And sometimes you have to fight some of the old battles over and over again for the next generation. For generation yet unborn, you too can make a contribution, and you must.
And now, Marianne Williamson.
The majority didn't wake up one day and say, oh, let's free the slaves. The majority didn't wake up one day and say, oh, let's give women the right to vote. It's always a small group of people, usually considered radicals by the status quo of their time, who stand on an idea that is truly aligned with the ages.
Deepak Chopra.
There's a body, there's a mind, but there's soul consciousness. Mm-hmm. And then when you get in touch with the soul consciousness, you become aware that other people also have a soul, and you communicate with that, and then you realize that you're both part of a more divine realm, and that's called divine consciousness. And then you can go even deeper into that in what is called unity consciousness, where you realize that we are all inseparably one. All the separation is totally artificial.
And now, my conversation with Charles Eisenstein.
We still live in communities that aren't really communities because we don't know the people around us.
Right.
We're surrounded by strangers.
Yeah.
So we feel lonely. If we're not actually separate selves, then our beingness, our sense of being in the world, depends on our relationships. And when our intimate relationships are only in the family, I'm not talking about sexual intimacy, I'm talking about really being known.
Yeah.
When we don't know our neighbors and we're not participating in the natural world, mm-hmm, in an intimate way, then we feel alone. We don't even know who we are. There's a deficit of identity when we're shrunk down into these little separate selves.
Yeah.
And this low-level suffering, this feeling that you're disconnected, even though you are in a world where you are engaging with people all the time, but there's this low-level sense of disconnection, mm-hmm, from community is what you're talking about. I love what you say. You say, on some level, we all know better. This knowledge seldom finds clear articulation. So instead, we express it indirectly through covert and overt rebellion. I find that so interesting. Addiction, self-sabotage, procrastination, laziness, rage, chronic fatigue, and depression are all ways that we withhold our full participation in the program of life that we are offered. Well said, sir.
If you're not a separate self,
yeah,
then what are you? You are maybe the mirror of all things, or you are the totality of your relationships. So that means that anything that happens to anything, to any being, is happening to you on some level.
Ah.
It means that any difficult relationship you have is mirroring something in yourself. It means that everything you do to the world will somehow come back to you. It means that the world outside of ourselves is not just a bunch of stuff, but it's a mirror of self. It has qualities like consciousness and intelligence that aren't just in human beings, but they're in all things. Everything that's happening to the world is happening to us. And whether or not we believe it, we can still feel it.
Yeah.
That's why it hurts so much. And we don't even know why.
Yes.
After my talk with Lynn Twist, I asked her to sit down with my girls from South Africa and share the lesson you're about to hear.
And when you let go of trying to get more of what you don't really need, it frees up oceans of energy that's caught up in that chase to turn and pay attention to what you already have. When you actually pay attention to, nourish, love, and share what you already have, it expands. It's the opposite of what we think. You're a perfect example of that, actually.
I was going to say, amen to that. I've seen it over and over and over and over. When you share it, it gets bigger.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you share it, it gets bigger.
And when people know that, it frees them from this chase of more and more and more and more and more. Because there's so much energy tied up in that in everybody's life. Even people who are just barely rubbing two nickels together to pay their rent. If they turn and pay attention to what they have, make a difference with it, share it, nourish it, it expands before their very eyes. A shorter way to say all that is what you appreciate, appreciates. What you appreciate, appreciates.
What you appreciate, appreciates. Mm-hmm. It's law, actually. Mm-hmm. It's a physical law that what you focus on expands, what you appreciate, appreciates.
Exactly. And then you have an experience of enough, actually. Mm-hmm. How we have an experience of sufficiency and is enough, how we have that kind of experience is by sharing, by contributing, by serving, by nourishing other people. That's where real prosperity lives.
Here are some meaningful insights from President Jimmy Carter.
We spend a full week every year in some remote place building habitat houses. One of the things that I've learned is that when we work side by side with a family that's never had a decent home in their lives, and we begin to comprehend quite clearly and vividly that their moral values are just as good as mine, and their ambitions are just as great as mine. We realize that in the past, just because somebody's poverty-stricken and deprived of what we look upon as successes in life, that they're inferior. And that's a major lesson I think I've learned in my adult life, and particularly since I left the White House, is that people are not inferior.
Mindy Kaling shares what she learned as a woman working in Hollywood.
As a woman who's an employee, often you are the only woman, and you think there's not enough space for me, or oh, there's only going to be one Indian woman, or there's only going to be one minority. I hope I'm it. I can't help anybody else. Those are the terrible habits you learn when you're younger, and when I was younger in the business, and then as you are as an employer, well, if I can stop that anxiety from young women, if there isn't only going to be one Indian woman, one African-American woman, one woman, period, in here, there's going to be space for lots, so you don't have to have that anxiety anymore. I think that's one way that we can help, or that I've tried to help.
And final thoughts on this chapter from Gary Zukav.
Give to the world what you want to receive from the world, because you will receive that.
Chapter 9, The Reward. Wealth is a tool that gives you choices, but it can't compensate for a life not fully lived. My father, Vernon Winfrey, graduated from Hazlabarber College in 1963. After working a year and a half as an apprentice, he opened his own barbershop in Nashville, where he's been a local fixture for the past 53 years. Before entering the Barber College, he served in the Army and held several other jobs, including as a janitor at Vanderbilt University. Both my mother, Vernita, and grandmother, Hattie Mae, were housekeepers. I was raised knowing the value of a hard day's work, and from an early age, I've always known I was responsible for myself. Where I came from, there was no backup plan or safety net. For better or worse, you made your own way. My first job was at 15 as a babysitter, making 50 cents an hour. The children were a handful, and the lady of the house always made sure to leave a big pile of clothes in her bedroom for me to clean up. Like clockwork, just before she left, she would turn to me and ask if I would mind tidying things up. When she came home and neglected to give me anything extra for cleaning, I understood very well that this woman didn't value my efforts. But I did. I valued my work and myself. And I decided that no matter how much or how little money I made, I would never let that define my worth. That babysitting job taught me my first valuable lesson about money. I am not my salary. I gave up babysitting and moved on to stocking shelves in a local store for $1.50 an hour. The pay was better, but I was not allowed to speak to the customers. As I mentioned in Chapter 4, I was known as a talking child, so this was clearly not a good fit. I knew having a job where I had to stay silent was no way to earn a paycheck. It felt like a betrayal of myself, and even at 15, I was not willing to do that. The experience turned out to be another life lesson. Sometimes knowing what you don't want is as valuable as knowing what you do. Eventually, I moved on to work for my father in his corner grocery store connected to the barbershop. I worked behind the counter selling penny candy. He didn't pay me, but I was allowed to talk. You could even say that the camaraderie in the barbershop and store explains why, years later, it felt so natural to be among the Oprah Show audience listening to stories. I was still in high school when I was offered a job as a newsreader at the local radio station. They paid me $100 a week. That was a lot of money for a 17-year-old, but I would have done it for free. It felt like the perfect fit. Lesson number 3, know the joy of doing what you love and never stop pursuing it. All these years later, I'm still keenly aware that I am not my salary. I give thanks every day for having the opportunity not only to make a living, but to create what I see as an exquisite life. And I know that everyone needs a source of income in order to survive. But I've come to believe that one of the reasons I've enjoyed financial success is because my focus has never been on money. As you experience these words of wisdom, my hope is that you will begin to develop a new measure for true success. For me, the great reward is the feeling of lasting contentment and self-respect that comes when you're living out the truth of who you are. One of the most memorable examples of the dangers of allowing material achievement to dictate self-worth is the story of author Sarah von Braunek. I've said for years that Sarah's best-selling book, Simple Abundance, is the reason I started keeping a gratitude journal. It changed the way I moved through the world. Simple Abundance sold 7 million copies. And before she knew it, Sarah was a multimillionaire. As a bona fide publishing superstar, she hired 9 assistants, brought home 8 pairs of Manolo Blahnik shoes in one trip, and bought the actual chapel once owned by Sir Isaac Newton. But 15 years later, Sarah joined me for a moving conversation in which she courageously shared the story of how she lost it all and what she eventually gained in return. What I learned from Sarah and so many others is that the way people handle money reflects the way they see themselves. Many times when people win the lottery and experience a windfall, they don't see themselves as worthy of their newfound riches. They wind up spending on possessions to create an idea of self-worth. When you've become blinded by the status symbols, it's easy to lose sight of the unique gifts only you can offer the world. What I know for sure is that no matter how much wealth you come to possess, everything passes and changes with time. What is real What is forever is who you are and what you're meant to share with the world. That is your true treasure. Let's start with more of my conversation with Sarah von Braunek.
I was number one for almost a year.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was on there for like 119 weeks.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
It is amazing. But what I wanted to share with you, and I've never shared because you don't get much sympathy for this, the Wednesday that there was no call. Oh, that's sort of strange.
We haven't heard from the New York Times today.
We haven't heard. They haven't called. And so I called my agent. I said, I haven't heard anything. She said, you're not on the list this week.
How was that?
I cried.
How was that after 119 weeks?
I cried. Yeah. And I thought, no one in the world will understand what this feels like. The only trouble with being number one is eventually you have to be number two, yeah, three, and four.
Because yeah, life moves on.
It does.
But hadn't you prepared yourself? One day you have to say, well, what's going to happen when that call doesn't come?
But I didn't.
You never did.
No. That's one of the lessons I wish I had realized. Mm. I wish I had learned that life is cyclical. Mm. Success goes in cycles.
The great Cicely Tyson has always known exactly who she is and what matters most.
When I read a script, either my skin tingles or my stomach churns. It's that simple. If my skin tingles, I know it's something that I must do. If my stomach churns, I know it is something that I cannot do. I have learned from every single character that I've played something. Something emotionally, spiritually, and psychologically true. I've never done a job just for money. I could not do anything that would not enhance humanity, especially women. It's so easy when the money is flashed before you to allow that to govern your choices. I've never really worked for money. It's so important for me to have peace of mind, body, and soul than to have all the riches. When I put my head on my pillow at night, I don't require a drug, alcohol, or anything else, just fatigue.
Michael Bernard Beckwith.
Once you release your grasp, then you give up your resistance, and then that which is for you will come to you.
That's the aha moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because when you want it, it doesn't show up.
Yeah. Your message to the universe at that moment is, I want it, which is translating into, I don't have it. So you can't receive it.
So you end up blocking your own blessing.
Totally.
Here's Lynn Twist.
I've learned a great deal from the people I used to call poor and the people I used to call rich. And now I just realize we're all whole and complete people living in the ebb and flow of financial circumstances that change all the time, that do not define us.
I thought it was interesting how you talk about how we question everything else. We question race, religion, other life circumstances, but money, we just give it the power.
We've assigned it more power than human life. You know, we all know that's not true, but we live as if money's more important than anything else, and it gives us tremendous anxiety and suffering. When we're dealing on the playing field of money, somehow we drop all of this wonderful sense of value and worth and love and relationship that we have in the rest of life.
Right.
And we become irritable and grumpy and greedy. And it's like there's different rules or something.
So you say in order to break that scarcity myth, there's not enough. We need to live in the place of sufficiency.
What I mean by sufficiency is a place of wholeness and completeness and deep understanding of who we are. And it's almost impossible to get to enoughness or sufficiency in a world that exalts scarcity. I call it the myth of scarcity. Mm-hmm. It's actually a mindset, an unconscious, unexamined set of assumptions that come before thinking, like a lens that we look through that has everything look like it's not enough. And we go through a day, waking up in the morning, I didn't get enough sleep. Then looking at the clock, I don't have enough time. Then there's not enough of this. I don't have enough to wear. And every meeting, every conversation, everything is about what we don't have enough of. It's the siren song of a consumer culture. But it's not just about money. It dribbles over into
everything.
Aspect of life.
Yes, yes.
We actually start to have a deficit relationship with ourselves. It's not just there's not enough, it's not enough. It's I'm not enough. And that deficit relationship with ourselves is the source of so much of our suffering. And it comes, I think, from this unconscious, unexamined mindset.
And if you believe that and buy into that, then that's exactly what you will create.
Exactly. And it gives people permission, actually, to accumulate way more than they need out of the fear that they're not going to have enough.
Here is Jack Canfield.
I think the greatest wound we've all experienced is somehow being rejected for being our authentic self. And that as a result of that, we then try to be what we're not to get approval, love, protection, safety, money, whatever. And that the real need for all of us is to reconnect with the essence of who we really are and re-own all the disowned parts of ourselves, whether it's our emotions, whether it's our spirituality. We all go around hiding parts of ourselves. And, you know, I was with a Buddhist teacher a number of years ago. We were co-leading a seminar, and he said at the end, he said, let me give you the secret. If you were to meditate for 20 years, this is where you'd finally get to. Just be yourself, but be all of you.
Here's Goldie Hawn.
The way I look at an award, it's a great thing to get looked and recognized for something that you've done. But it's a moment in time. Living off of those accolades and making that become the sum total and the part of your importance in life, or even your purpose in life, defining who you are. Those awards are never, they're wonderful. They're never going to define who you are. I define myself by my ability to give. I define myself by my ability to understand. I define myself by my ethics. And by my truth. These are the things that inform who I am, other than exterior moments that come and ebb and flow.
Jordan Peele experienced the kind of success people dream about. He shared how he works to stay focused on what really matters.
It was an article in Vanity Fair about Michael Jackson, and his friends were commenting saying he did Thriller and then spent the rest of his life chasing Thriller. So how do you now avoid the trap of your first film, first directing, first written, becomes this phenomenon?
Now that you mention it, I don't know. I don't. You know, I will continue to make the movies that I want to see first. If I want to see it, I have to have trust that other people will. And if they don't, I have to accept that that's what it is.
Yeah.
The biggest reward of all of this for me, besides this right here, has always been the fact that I get to make another movie. I don't want to let that become an unpleasant experience because this one was so successful.
Jeff Weiner reveals what failure taught him.
If that doesn't humble you, I don't know what is. Mm-hmm. So when you have those kinds of experiences, you realize how at times fleeting success can be, at least traditional measures of success. You realize to some extent how beyond your control it is, and you invest less in it in terms of the way you define yourself. Success in terms of achieving objectives, in terms of manifesting a mission, in terms of manifesting a vision, that's all good, especially if what you can do can create good in the world. That's fantastic. But to the extent you start to define yourself through traditional measures of success, to the extent that's your source of self-esteem, you are destined to be unhappy because you cannot control it.
Listen to how growing up in poverty helped shape Trevor Noah's perspective.
You know, my whole life, comedy has always been a tool that I've used to process pain. It's how my family communicated. It's one thing we had. We always laughed. And you've been to Soweto. You've seen how we live there. You know, the weird thing is, when I always say to people, when you're poor, like, being poor sucks, but being poor together makes it a lot better, right? Because you're in it together, and you don't, it doesn't discount the fact that you don't have, but then you start to enjoy the things that you do have, and that is each other. And so we laughed, we enjoyed ourselves, we had something that sometimes you don't have when you have too much, and that is the ability to focus on the human beings around you.
And now, William Paul Young.
We live in this world where we're just all looking for more and more and more and more, and we're looking for more things to fill us up and more things to make us whole. But the opposite of more is enough.
Yes.
When is enough enough?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, isn't it?
Yeah, that is.
As soon as you ask it, you're already thinking more.
Yeah.
And that really came to fruition in dealing with the loss of everything financial and all
yes.
that. And when we lost everything, was dealing with a major fear. I can trace my journey on the issue of trust, because that was so violated as a child that I had no inclination, let alone capacity, to trust anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And now, through these 11 years, I have all these men in my life that have really brought healing to my soul, right? Help rebuild the house on the inside. So I call them up and I say, look, I know you love us. Here's our financial situation. I know you love my family. Please, please, don't rescue me from this.
Don't rescue me from this?
Yeah, don't. Because when you run into these issues where fear has such a dominant place, you're either gonna go to control or you're gonna go to trust.
Yeah.
Right? And my whole thing, my whole life has been about control, because I couldn't trust. So when I run into these things, it's like, how do I let go of control here? In this situation, it was, please don't rescue me from this, because you're probably going to be interfering with what God is doing in my heart.
You let yourself fall?
Yeah.
You allowed yourself to fall. You allowed yourself to
fall. I allowed myself to fall into trust. And that's when we learned that the opposite of more is enough.
Chapter 10, Home. You already know. Throughout my life, and I bet yours too, certain works of literature and film have completely changed the lens through which I see the world. This list is long for me, but there are two classics in particular that I treasure. I was in my early years of high school, living with my mother in Milwaukee, when a librarian made a recommendation that would change me forever. She noticed that I checked out 5 books each visit and said, if you like reading these kinds of books, you might like To Kill a Mockingbird. She was right. The moment I picked it up, I was entranced. The story of Boo Radley, Scout, and Atticus Finch is probably the reason I started a book club, because it was one of the first books that I wanted everyone around me to read. I was drawn to Scout's spirit. I felt a kinship with her curiosity and admired that, despite her age, young Scout knew exactly who she was and what she believed. I felt emboldened by Scout. At the time, I was awakening to the idea of racism, just like her, and her eyes were opening to the complex realities of the world, just like mine. I also wanted the kind of relationship Scout had with her father, Atticus, especially when she called him by his first name. Many years after I'd read the book, I found myself at a luncheon seated next to Gregory Peck, who, of course, portrayed Atticus in the movie version of the book. The only words I could think to say were, "So, how's Scout?" Mr. Peck was gracious and answered my question about his co-star who played the little girl. "Well," he said, "that was 40 years ago, so she's okay." To me, Scout was as powerful a character that day as she was the first time I opened the book and then saw her come to life in the movie. A part of Scout will reside in me for the rest of my life. It was the plight of another strong-willed girl in one of the most beloved films of all time that unlocked an early spiritual awakening for me. I was 7 or 8 when I figured out that The Wizard of Oz was more than a story about a bump on the head and a fantastical dream. The moment I realized that the scarecrow, the tin man, the Cowardly Lion were actually Dorothy's friends from Auntie M's farm, something clicked deep within. I didn't have the words to express it at the time, but as I grew into my own path of awareness, I understood The Wizard of Oz to be one of the great spiritual teachings of all time. Dorothy was on what the great philosopher Joseph Campbell so famously called a hero's journey. The yellow brick road represented the path toward her true self. Along the way, she encountered the disempowered parts of herself, the scarecrow's wish for a brain, the tin man's desire for a heart, the cowardly lion's longing for courage. Like so many of us, Dorothy believed she needed something outside herself. In her case, the great and powerful Oz, to bestow the cherished virtues on her friends and bring her home. But in what I believe is the most powerful moment of the film, Glinda the Good Witch says the words that spiritual teachers have been trying to convey for thousands of years. "You don't need to be helped any longer," Glinda tells Dorothy. "You've always had the power." Dorothy's most trusted companion, the Scarecrow, asks Glinda, "Then why didn't you tell her before?" And Glinda replies, "Because she wouldn't have believed me. She had to learn it for herself." This was probably the greatest aha moment of my life. No matter how far away from yourself you may have strayed, there is always a path back. You already know who you are and how to fulfill your destiny, and your ruby slippers are ready to carry you home. Just before Dorothy clicks her heels, she shares the universal lesson that applies to each and every person here on Earth. "If I ever go looking for my heart's desire again, I won't look any further than my own backyard, because if it isn't there, I never really lost it to begin with." The final chapter of this book is meant to illustrate that you have the power to discover your purpose and live your greatest truth. It doesn't matter how many yellow brick roads you encounter, it has always been right there, at home, in your own backyard, in your heart. We'll begin with Debbie Ford.
"What I know for sure is that we are all created with this phenomenal force inside of us that can have us withstand, like that God never gives us more than we can handle. And that everything that comes our way is coming our way so that we can grow and evolve. And if we look at it like that, if we're willing to open our hearts and see where we're shut down, where we're trying to resist life, then we have the great opportunity to step into who we always wanted to be."
Here's Father Richard Rohr.
"All spiritual knowledge is not cognition, it's recognition. You're re-knowing what you deeply already knew.
Yeah.
What you deeply intuited, suspected, desired, hoped for, that's the soul. The discovery of myself and the discovery of God will eventually be parallel movements. Well, initially too, that you fall into one and you fall into the other. You fall deeper into yourself, you fall deeper into God. You fall deeper into God, you have permission to fall deeper into yourself, even warts and all, you know? So they sort of play back and forth."
Sue Monk Kidd.
"I have this phrase that I call the old woman, and I say that with great fondness. My daughter and I went on travels and wrote a book, Traveling with Pomegranates. And on those journeys, I was searching for that old woman, the woman I wanted to grow into. She's wise. She's bold. She's strong and resilient. She knows her voice. She speaks it, and she stands by it." Mm. This is the old woman for me. She's distilled down. In my novel, The Invention of Wings, there's a moment where Handful looks at Sarah, my character, at the end,
yes,
and she says, "She's been boiled down into a good, strong broth."
I love that
line. I want to be that. I want to be a good, strong broth that has those qualities of the old woman I went off searching for.
And now, Elizabeth Gilbert.
What did you discover that you never knew you had?
That I can take care of myself completely. I got my own back. That I can take care of myself. And I don't just mean financially. I mean emotionally. That I know that I became a responsible enough adult to be allowed to be alone with the child who is inside of me. I can take care of you.
And you know that no matter what, you're going to be all right.
I'm going to be all right.
Elizabeth Lesser defines the simplicity of love.
In the end, I know the lesson you wish for all of us is to live each day from the marrow.
Yeah. We think that the answer to life is complicated or you got to go on some big quest for it. And it turns out to be you're enough just because you are.
You're enough.
And find the seed of enoughness in the other person. Now, give them that gift. You're enough, too. And that's where love is. That is the seed of love to people who know who they are in their grand simplicity. Seeing each other beyond the labels, beyond the ego, just being enough with each other.
The legendary Sidney Poitier.
I am most proud of being accepted as a useful human being. Useful to my children, to my parents who are no longer here, to my friends, to my environment. I'm not the human being that I would one day hope to be, but I've come a long way. I really have come a very, very long way. And I'm proud of that. Because I am indeed a better person than once I ever was. We are imperfect creatures. We are. That's what it is. But we should try reaching for the better you, the better me. There is pain and there is difficulties and there is fears and all the kinds of things that we live with. But it is through them we have to reach. We have to reach out, not just to each other, but to the universe.
Jack Canfield.
My belief is that the whole purpose of life is to gain mastery, mastery of our emotions, our finances, our relationships, our consciousness through meditation, things like that. And it's not about the stuff. All the stuff can be taken away. People lose their fortunes. They lose their reputation. Beautiful spouses die or leave you, but who you became in the process can never be taken away. Never. You are mastering through the process of overcoming these obstacles that you face in life.
And now, Ellen DeGeneres.
I'm in a relationship now where I have equal love, that I love her and she loves me and we respect each other and we're kind and we're gentle. And as someone once said, it's wonderful to be loved, but it's profound to be understood.
Sean Acor helps us understand what we really need to appreciate.
You all have all heard it. Is the glass half empty or the glass half full? Well, you're saying, what does it matter if you have a pitcher nearby?
That's right. I think that there's a different way of even looking at this. We get so focused on the glass. We can argue forever and ever between optimists and pessimists, and both can say that they're being unrealistic. But it doesn't matter if we looked at more of the world and saw that there's a pitcher of water that's sitting next to it.
What about the people who say, I don't have no pitcher?
I think that we do. I think that we do the more we connect to other people around us.
I would say the world itself is the pitcher.
Yeah.
Life is the pitcher.
The life is the pitcher. And we're missing the pitcher sometimes when we're so focused on that one element. But if we look for other ways, we can actually fill up that glass. And so I actually could care less about whether it's half full or half empty right now if I could fill it up. And so that's what we have people start to look for is, how do I connect to other people around me? How do I believe my behavior matters?
Boy, that changed me. That's good. Oh, God, that's a good one.
Wonderful.
I could care less if it's half empty or half full.
Yes.
If you have the picture to fill it up.
Robin Roberts shares what she's learned seeing her life as an eternal optimist.
Optimism is like a muscle that gets stronger with use. When you want to build a muscle, you got to keep using it. But that's how you have to be. And I'm an internal optimist. And so I can find those little silver linings, those little moral victories. God has three answers to prayer. Yes, not yet, and I have something even better in mind. I always like the third one. I always feel there is something better in mind. I feel that for others too, that the best is yet to come. And it takes courage to believe that the best is yet to come.
Here's my aha moment with Jean Houston.
I believe that we are here with deep purpose to become all that we can be. I believe that we have been given the most beautiful planet in the galaxy to work out and to enjoy. It isn't just a working out. It is truly to enjoy the gifts of our incarnation. I believe that we are headed ultimately in the right direction. I believe that we have been given sufficient stress, crisis, complexity, and consciousness to do things that are beyond our imagination, larger than our aspiration, more complex than all our dreams. I believe in love. I believe in you. I believe in me. I believe in this, the most potent moment in human history.
Jane Fonda shares how she's lived her life with purpose and intention.
I've done a lot of things in my life. There's a lot of parts to my life. I have thought very deliberately and intentionally a lot about my life and why certain things happen and what they mean and so forth. I learned that the goal is to be whole, to be of a piece, to reside inside your skin. I don't want to die tomorrow, but if I do, I go out happy. Because I've worked hard at making the most of what I've been given. My best legacy is my life. And the lesson is, it's never too late.
Gary Zukav encapsulates our path made clear.
It's just like The Wizard of Oz, one of my favorite spiritual teachings. It's just like the moment when the Wicked Witch of the West is trying to get to Dorothy and Glinda says, go away, you have no power here. You have no power here because the goodness and the light is so strong that the Wicked Witch of the West has no ability to affect that territory.
That's right. I wouldn't say that the universe, I understand this story and I love it too. Mm-hmm. By the way, I come from Kansas. And I understand it. The universe doesn't look in terms of good, bad, better, worse, success, failure. It looks in terms of limitation and opportunity. The more the loving parts of your personality are the ones you're cultivating, the more opportunity you have.
Absolutely.
The more fear is controlling you, and the more limitation you have.
But isn't the ultimate lesson where Glinda says to Dorothy, you've always had it, my dear. You've always had the power. Isn't that the ultimate lesson we're all trying to remember?
Yes, it is. That you are a powerful and creative, compassionate and loving spirit. And the more you cultivate a loving part of your personality, the more it begins to fill your experience and your field of awareness until that's all that is.
Epilogue. Nourish what makes you feel confident, connected, contented. Opportunity will rise to meet you. Some of the most meaningful experiences on The Oprah Winfrey Show happened when it was perfectly still, just a single person on the stage sharing a story so intimate you had to hold your breath just to hear it. Years ago, I interviewed a grieving mother whose adult son had died after a long illness. You could have heard a pin drop in the studio when she so beautifully told the story of their final moment together. The mother had climbed into bed with her son. She could barely hear him, but her head was on his chest. As he took his last breath, he whispered, "Oh, Mom. It is all so simple. It's so simple, Mom." He then closed his eyes and died. I got chills when I heard that.
I realized then, just as it resonates with me now, we allow life to get so complicated when it's really so very simple. From that day forward, I resolved to continually ask myself, how am I making things more difficult than they need to be? Your answer to that same question is the next step in your path. It's that simple. Imagine what lies just around the bend. Can you see it? I can.
We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Path Made Clear, a Macmillan Audio production for Flatiron Books. This title was produced by Guy Oldfield. Text copyright 2019 by Oprah Winfrey. Production copyright 2019 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.